Come one, come all, welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 65, Love Boat Part 5, Naughty or Nice. I am Tatiana, introducing today's episode, and I am here with
Jessica
and May.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash, and you can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter. Ladies, wgumption@gmail.com if you want to send us a nice long email, or ladieswgumption.tumblr.com if you can avoid being recognized as a porn bot. So, and don't forget that we are still on Facebook. Now you can actually interact with us on Facebook. We will post this podcast on there, and you can listen through either that way or iTunes or Google Play. So let's get this party started with Doom Patrol being greenlit for a second season, which I guess means DC Universe must not be doing terribly. It must believe it will exist for more than 1 year. So, snap, DC Universe. What do you guys think? Feelings?
Well, I mean, considering like how much they've already put behind it, just off the bat, it seemed like it was going to be greenlit for a second season. I think Titans was greenlit for a second season before it premiered too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, they're expecting good things, so hopefully they deliver on them.
Fingers crossed! Alright, now we've got mountains of feedback with Gumption, of course. That's the only feedback that we accept. Starting with some feedback from yesteryear. It's not really yesteryear, we're still in 2018, but from last week that we didn't make it onto the podcast, from KJ, our fave dude that sends us feedback. So he wanted to clarify some things about his Titans feelings, which actually fit with what we were already talking about because he is psychic. So he said, I completely understand and agree that the marginalization of one non-character slash actress is egregious, but my argument is that she should have a deep character exploration too, more than Hank, Dove, and Donna, and ideally as much as Dick and Raven. But I guess the show considers them the main two. I'm optimistic that Anna will get more to do in season two. Maybe when the cliffhanger is resolved, we can see how Corey feels about those events and her recent revelations about herself. And again, fuck plot. So I think I agree with this. Like, obviously, if they all got equal amounts of deep character exploration, then I would have no issue with right. not having a plot. My issue is that they'll give you plot and then take it away for an episode about characters that don't matter at all, named Hank, Dove, Donna, Jason, etc. So, yes. KJ followed up his old email with a new one in which he says the following things. Love Boat was an old series from the 70s, 80s on ABC. It has nothing to do with your topic, but I'm informing you anyways.
I know that.
I have never seen it myself, but it's held in high regard by many, I believe. It's one of Aaron Spelling's many TV shows. I'm actually surprised that it's never been remade. Also, Barry and Iris are clearly the best couple. Well, wonderful. Or has it been remade?
I don't think it has.
This is irrelevant, KJ.
he's putting the like salient information in between, in parentheses, in between his Love Boat information. He's being very sneaky. I'm sure Nyssa deserves better than Sarah, the latter whom never seemed to be into the former. That's true. Aww. I'm not gonna lie, when I saw Sarah and Nyssa, I was a little bit disappointed because I was like, this is the bisexual representation, like Nyssa seems insane and like trying to kidnap her family members, and Sarah is just like all up in Oliver's business. So I was really annoyed. But then later on, I liked them much more, and now I love Ava Lance, so it's fine. Anyway, I wonder if my library has. I still don't understand how there wasn't more backlash about Supergirl switching from James, who was respectful of Kara, to Mon-El, the slave owner that was always disrespectful to her. The DVD of Love Boat. Yes, I still watch DVDs. Oliver and Felicity were too sped up in season two, I think. That's 100% accurate. I mean, there was like, you literally saw the switch turn on from, you know.
Yeah.
Felicity.
301. The finale or whatever of season two. And 301 is just like a...
I love you, Felicity. Yep. I'm just like, huh?
Whiplash.
Right. Also, season one of Titans didn't have a big bad, but season two will. Okay. Sorry, I don't agree with you, but I'd never call you four. Four?
There's not four of us.
Yeah, there's three of us. But I guess there's four in spirit. Who would be our fourth? I don't know. The Holy Spirit is
all
with
the
us.
Feedback. Okay. All the feedback is our fourth.
Thank you, KJ. We don't think you're stupid either. And we love your feedback all the time. Your feedback is good all the time. All right.
All the time.
All the time, your feedback is good. We've got feedback from Joe. She said she sent in an ask on Tumblr about Kara not having a love interest this season. She agrees that Kara and Alex is probably the true anchorship of Supergirl and Kara's most important relationship. However, that shouldn't mean she can't have a love life. I wouldn't even mind if she had several temporary love interests if they don't want to commit to an endgame. But I do think that the writers have to be invested in writing love life for her. That's not problematic the way that Mon-El was. Also, I listened again to the last Love Boat podcast and the preseason one review. Oh, sorry, in the preseason review one, and had a couple of thoughts that maybe you could touch on. I think we all had high hopes for Joe and Cecile as the beta ship for the Flash, but none of us expected JLM's injury and resulting absence. Now I wonder if they promoted Danielle Nicolette to a regular because they knew Jesse wouldn't be around as much. Also, unlike previous seasons of Flash, so far there haven't been any other romantic relationships featured besides Barry and Iris. Instead, familial relationships, particularly fathers and daughters, have become the theme. And a note about Arrow and its anchorship. My theory is that the writers like Oliver and Felicity individually as characters, but they aren't strongly invested in them as a couple. Or, not anymore. I think they may have been in previous seasons. Them being a couple doesn't drive stories. And I think that may be one reason why they don't have any problem having storylines where they're separated for long stretches of time. Or reminding everyone of Oliver's promiscuity in the crossover.
Yes.
Shang! Our other favorite dude who sends us feedback. While listening for the podcast, waiting for my Christmas dinner to start, I'm not a very chatty kid and prefer to keep to myself. Aw. Podcasts help me relax because a large audience gives me anxiety mostly. I understand that. I remember my first podcast listen, the Crisis on Earth X episode. I laughed a whole lot because tea, and then started from episode one. I soon started watching The Flash, too, after hearing how wonderful Iris West Allen is. Ah! Thank you for starting this podcast. It really helps validate the voices of us out here who are tired of white fanboys and their dumbass privileged opinions. You ladies have always had such a reasonable and objective voice in fandom. I appreciate that you don't sugarcoat characters and educate about topics of intersectionality, racism, LGBTQ, sexism, and quite interesting privilege of the colonizers. Aw, thank you. We love you, Shang. You are the best. All right. Yay, so, he's got DC streaming service feedback. I fairly enjoy Titans due to the dark grittiness and merciless action scenes, though I do have issues with their plots itself. Hawk and Dove seem very irrelevant to me, and I want more Corey, and their super white-looking cast. I'm super surprised they're bringing in Superboy. I feel like I'm one of the few that dislike him, or he seems very arrogant to me, especially on Young Justice. I would have rather had Tara or Bumblebee, maybe even Roy or Wally first. One man pain story of Dick is enough. I don't need a Connor man pain story as well.
Yeah, well, it's coming. It's coming, Shang.
Yeah, we are with you on that, but unfortunately, it's here coming. We go.
I would love Bumblebee to come on, though. That would be awesome.
Yeah, same. So, yeah, he thinks they need to rework their storytelling because it didn't flow this well this season, and I totally agree. He also said he's excited for Doom Patrol. Yep. I think we're getting the Justice Society and Injustice Society in the works. Interesting. That would be kind of fun. Would you ladies be having any feedback for other streaming service shows during the podcast episodes? I feel like we're going to do Doom Patrol. I feel like it's coming. Yeah. I feel like it's going to happen.
At least Doom Patrol. And I'm pretty sure, like, Stargirl, we'll probably start all of them
at some point. Exactly. We'll probably do at least a review of the first episode or the first chunk of episodes. And then we could probably keep it going as long as there's only one on at a time. You know? We'll see how we continue from there. Then we got some feedback from Mara, a relatively new listener. Thank you, Mara. It's very long, so it will mostly be on Tumblr, but I will read a couple of things. I will skip over the wonderful compliments, but thank you for them. I'll start with The Flash. This is my favorite of shows. I think Flash benefits from Barry and Iris being comic book royalty. It didn't invade my notice that Supergirl clearly enjoyed writing Clark and Lois during Elseworlds more than any other romance it's done. but more on that later. That's mm-hmm. true. I didn't even think about that, but yep. Mm-hmm. the pilot episode was not shy in establishing West Allen as the OTP, with movie moments like Iris racing into Barry's arms and the lightning rod connection being teased right off the bat. They loved each other deeply right from the start, and I think that's what makes them so fascinating for the Flash writers. It's an interesting challenge. How many ways can they write these two showcasing how much they love each other and how they always find each other? Ooh, I love that. Great. Great point. I was definitely worried after season 3 that the writers would lose interest in the romance aspect. And while we're never going to get peak early romance goodness, the investment hasn't wavered. Storylines are still crafted around them. All Dolled Up was right on par with Flashpoint at a time and cause and effect when it came to West Allen content. And it reinforced just how much the writers love writing these two as crazy in love, best friends, parents, and a team. And that's where the show draws strength, its investment in all aspects of West Allen, which is why it's able to maintain its ratings, its spot as number one on the network, and its narrative consistency. Flash has flaws, and I certainly want more when it comes to Iris, but I've never seen a couple treated with such narrative importance and such respect on a superhero show. Thank you, Mara. Thank you. Preaching to the choir, but yes, this is what it's all about. Like, as much as we complain, this is where it's at. All right. So she's got some questions here for us. Do you think that, one, because narrative investment in West Allen squarely places the relationship at the heart of the show, West Allen adds immensely to the superhero show rather than detracts from it? Do you think that part of the reason the writer successfully avoided unnecessary drama and typical superhero romance tropes is because their history as childhood best friends provided an opportunity to craft massive storylines that depended on the strength of their relationship? Mm-hmm. And two, do you think Flash generally lacks investment in secondary romance? One, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And two, 100% yes. This is accurate. For Arrow, why do you think, one, writers feel the need to create internal conflict for Olicity? It was more authentic this season, but the resolution was poorly pieced together. Two, does writer investment in Olicity depend on teaching Oliver lessons in love? I guess I found it bizarre that the writers thought it necessary to compare and contrast West Allen and Olicity, but didn't think it was important to resolve residual issues about their relationship. Three, this begs the question, do the Arrow writers struggle seeing Oliver as a romantic hero, period, given how they treated Laurel and Oliver? Or is this specific to Olicity?
I think that for that one, I do think that they struggle seeing Oliver as a one-woman kind of man, because that's not really how he was set up in the beginning of the show. Like, it was that was a whole issue at contrast with, you know, building up Oliver and Laurel, is that they didn't have Oliver as a one-woman kind of man. They kind of had him as, like, a playboy, and so there was a direct contrast there, and I don't think they ever really got out of that. And then I think where the Flash writers build on the strength of Barry and Iris' relationship, and they're inspired by that. On the opposite side, I think the Arrow writers are more interested when stuff is not going right with Oliver and Felicity, mm-hmm. and they draw interest from that. So every time there's, like, a crossover, suddenly Oliver and Felicity have issues.
And I do think it's what's interesting about that is that with regards to the crossover is that they don't ever resolve, like you said, their issues, because they put them in conflict, but then they're right back to the same issue, like the next crossover, you know, it's always something, whether it's like trust or they're having communication problems, but specifically Felicity's issues, like Crisis on Earth X, it was like the fact that she didn't want to get married because she thought things were going well between them, and Oliver kind of pushed the issue. And this year it was like lack of trust and respect, and Oliver gave a nice speech, but he didn't really acknowledge her issues and help to resolve that part of it. So that's why they're always bouncing back to the same thing.
And then before that, and the second one is because he had like a secret child that he didn't tell her about.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Yep.
It's kind of like, if you see like the pattern, like all of them is just like presents Oliver in just the worst light ever and him having to grow from it. But then they don't even address it because it just comes back around the next time. So. They don't like their protagonist, which is weird.
Well, yeah. It definitely does stem from them not seeing him, like you guys said, as a romantic hero. Because that's not how he's ever been. I mean, even in this year's crossover, he wasn't like, he was laughing at Barry saying, like, just tell Iris, you know, she's your lightning rod. He's like,
no, he's not the cheesy romance guy.
Right, he's not.
Yes, I agree with this. I mean, I think, like, I've said this before in other circumstances, but writers will write what they want, right? As many excuses as they give for why something isn't happening, if they write a couple to continue to have internal problems and, like, go over the same issues that are never really resolved over and over again, it's because they don't see them outside of that, mm-hmm. right? Whereas if they continue to write them, like, as much as they little problems crop up, but they won't let them be angry at each other for more than an episode, it's because they can't imagine them angry at each other. That's why they write it that way.
Very nice.
Anyway, moving on. In relation to Supergirl, one, would Supergirl benefit from having Kara in a romantic relationship? I can't see an endgame romantically in relation to Kara, and they seem more interested in Coral Nia at the moment, which obviously is opposite to Caradox that was canon in the comics. Two, what do you make of the contrast in Supergirl writers' clear investment in Clois over any Kara ship? Is it because they are celebrated as comic book royalty and Kara doesn't have an equivalent romance? Or is there another reason?
I think we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, we will be talking about this. We will be discussing in the podcast.
Yes. Well, I know for me, I didn't directly acknowledge, I didn't think about Clois either when I was putting together my notes and stuff, but certainly they have like comic backstory that they can draw from, and to them it might be more exciting to write.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that basically there's definitely more that they can go from. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's probably the thing. Like if you're writing for Supergirl, you probably also like Superman, and you probably have been waiting for a chance to write Clois. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's unlikely that you were waiting for a chance to write Kara with anyone because the comics haven't even given that much.
Yeah, but we're going to get into it later, I think. But also, like, they went light speed with Clois mm-hmm. all in that one little thing. And I feel like
they did all the things.
Yeah. There's romance, and then there's, like, you know, first comes love, first comes things, comes bears, then comes a baby, all in, like, 3 hours.
Yes. Yeah, they were like, first comes love, then comes the baby, and then it's like, well, shit, we're
doing
here.
Everything, like, right now.
Black Lightning has been kind of messy this season compared to how good it was in season one. One, do you think hyper-focus on Khalil and Jennifer has detracted from the show's central narrative? And two, yes, we're going to be talking about that for sure. There's more writer investment in that than Jennifer and Issa. So do you think that superseded Jefferson Lynn? Yes, and we'll be talking about that. And it's hurting the show overall? Yes. All right, Titans started out. This is like the bottle recap. Like a little, like, previously on the
love podcast book. Preview on the podcast.
Exactly. Titans started out really strong. Establishing Decoria's partners, romantic love interests, pseudo-parents. Things start to become messy post-Don and Hank. I'm not sure what to make of them in terms of anchor ships and submarine ships, and we will be discussing that for sure. But that's the show is so Dick-focused and so Dick and Rachel-focused. I love Donna, but I don't like how they presented the Don versus Corey thing in her head. Yep, I agree. I totally agree with you, but I also feel like the Titans writers are already fumbling the way that you have said. We will talk about all your points more in depth on the Tumblr. And finally, we've got Renee. More love boat feedback. She talked about the love language, which we are going to be circling back to your feedback specifically when we get to West Allen on the Flash portion. It's been really rewarding to watch a superhero show on the CW of all places portray a healthy, functioning couple while still finding ways to keep them fresh and exciting. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the Golden Child has in store for the second half of the season and to hear what you ladies have to say. And yes, I think that's the biggest, the most salient point is that West Allen and the Flash has found a way to be both fun with their ship and healthy, right? And like a lot of times writers will see like healthy is boring, right? Or just not even like a couple will be boring and then fans will say, oh, it's healthy. It's like, yes, nothing's happening. Like, yeah, of course it's helping. So the Flash has managed to balance that really well. So thank goodness. And then finally, we have Tumblr feedback. Here we go. Love Boat is this week. Okay. I'm excited to hear this week's episode because it's been an interesting season for romance and DCTV. I was wondering if you might address some questions I have during the podcast. The Flash doesn't seem to enjoy riding submarine ships. Accurate. And then they brought up Cisco and Cynthia and Joe and Cecile. especially when compared to how much the writers are clearly invested in Barry and Iris.
It didn't used to be that way, because they used to have, like, too many ships, so now there's, like, zero ships except the main ship.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, it's also probably because you get new writers cycling in.
Yeah.
So those writers have the strongest investment to the thing that the show's really about. And then the other stuff, it's like, I didn't write that. I don't really care about that. It can go. So that's what I would imagine. Do you think that's the reason? You just asked, what's the reason for the lack of investment? That's the reason. Congratulations. All right. Going off that, while it's too early to tell, do you think Ralph and Sue are going to get better development than Joan Cecile and Cisco Cynthia? We yes. will be discussing that. Yes, the answer is yes, but we will be talking about that. And it might be partially because they can draw direct inspiration from Wes Allen and because Ralph is a white man. Yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. 3. Does Supergirl really need an anchor ship, given that Carlson and Caramel never took off, for reasons, and because Alex and Kara's sisterhood already anchors the show? I think it needs an anchor ship from a writing point of view. I think an anchor ship is the most basic way to spin off plots from one sentence. And the Supergirl writers, I think, have shown that they could really use one sentence focus. That's my thought.
We'll get into it.
We'll get into it. Writing for Guardian Corp would improve if there was an anchor ship anchoring the submarine ship. Less lost at sea writing. We are definitely going to talk about that. You are correct. And the Black Lightning writers are relying far too much on the submarine Jaleel. Oh, is that the ship name? Jaleel?
I thought it was Kinnifer. Yes, they are. But, yeah. But they're not really a submarine ship, because that's the only ship on the show at the moment.
They are the ship.
They are. The ship. Yeah, they're not the anchor ship you want, but they're the anchor ship you have.
And with all of these previews in mind, May is finally going to lead us into the actual body of this episode. The Love Boat. Once again, we discuss the state of DCTV's anchor / alpha ships and submarine / beta ships. We'll talk about how they fared this season, or really this year, how they fared in 2018, what their status means for the structure of the show moving forward in the back half of the season, and Jessica has been so kind as to add a crack ship corner for us. And this time we will discuss what our crack ships are, which ships we wish could make it into one of those categories. And finally, we will rate the shows as being naughty or nice to the ships. Do they get gifts from us this year for their behavior, or do they have coal in their stockings?
As a preview, I think most of them ended up in the naughty list, but we'll get to that anyway.
Spoilers.
So everyone's really excited about this episode, The Love Boat. It's one of my personal favorites as well. This episode will focus on like the structure of the anchor ships in the shows and how like the strength of the foundation for the ship, the writer's emotional investment in the ship, and the reception of the audience, and how it can either contribute or, you know, mess everything up within the narrative of the show. And just because a show gets it right with its primary ship doesn't mean it gets its secondary ships right, which we've seen on many of the shows. And conversely, a show struggling with its primary ship can benefit from having a strong beta ship, but still probably needs an anchor. So in what ways do we think secondary ships complement the primary and then contribute to the overall narrative for all of the ships? But before we get into that, we have to talk about Kara and why she basically doesn't have any love interest in comparison to like Oliver and Barry.
Well, first I was going to say that like we got an Anon, and I'm guessing this was Joe, like her Anon on Tumblr sparked off a whole other series of Anons of people like asking us to talk about, you know, Kara's love life or lack thereof. It's specifically in comparison to Oliver and Barry, who are the other 2 points of the trio, and them being men, and they get like several temporary intermediary love interests until they settle on their OTPs. But Kara is kind of like the strong woman don't need no man right now. And then, like, a non-mention that Kara not needing one is because the Danvers sisters' relationship fills the same function. And then another one was like, well, yeah, like, that Kara and Alex are, like, a strength of the show, but it shouldn't be compared to someone like Wes Allen because one is siblings, the other one isn't. So, like, anchorships, is it the same thing or is it not? So, I guess, like, I agree with the non that Kara and Alex's relationship anchors their show. But I was thinking about it, and I think that there are two ways to anchor a show. So we've been talking about anchors as far as like romance or love, but there's also like the heart of the show. And Flash is lucky in that Barry's heart is also his romantic love interest in Iris. So, but like it wasn't always that way, because in season one, the heart was definitely Joe Barry. Like that was like the heart of the show. And they worked on setting up his romantic love with Iris, but midway into season two, you can kind of tell that they started backing off on Joe Barry and started replacing Joe with Iris in those heart-to-heart scenes. And she's been his heart anchor and his love anchor since then. So Wes Allen anchors the Flash like two times over, whereas Supergirl's heart is Kara and Alex, and like minorly Alex and John, I think, are the like the secondary heart anchor. But then Kara doesn't have a romantic anchor. And then on Arrow, Oliver's heart is his heart and his romantic anchors are split. So I would argue that William is his heart anchor, while obviously Felicity is like the love romantic anchor. And then Tati said like his heart used to be Thea, like his sister. So he's got like a family anchor, and then he's got like his romantic anchor. So Arrow is one of the shows that kind of uses two anchors instead of one. Supergirl only has one, and Flash has both of them are the same ship. And so I think that's why if you look at the, like, the Elseworlds crossovers, Arrow felt the most hollow of the three because it was missing Oliver's heart, a.k.a. William. So like Barry is like, if Iris believes me, I'll be all right. Kara's like, if Alex believes me, I'll be all right. Oliver, queen. Like, that's what it was.
So, I would like also that, yeah. argue that for yeah. including Iris as like the heart and the anchor on the Flash, it also benefits Barry because the Wests are also his family, so it's, like, all tied in together.
Yeah, it's all centered.
Yeah.
Which is, that probably strengthens just, like, West Allen as a ship overall, because Iris is, functions as both the heart anchor and the romance anchor for Barry. But we'll get more into that, because I started, like, going off on tangents.
Yeah. I mean, the basic answer is sexism, because... They, you know, how, like, writers, I feel like writers, the first thing writers take away from women, fictional women, is the romance aspect, because they think that if they have it, people won't be interested in it or anything like that, or she can't be, like, strong and want a career and all these other things.
Exactly.
She did. So take away the romance, and then she can have all the rest of it, but then they remove that aspect of it because they think people are not going to like it or whatever, or they think it's, like, she'll be too dependent on it, which is... obviously a mistake, and because people hate women.
Yep, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. We'll start with the Golden Child, the Flash. So anchorship is obviously West Allen. So tell me your feels and how, you know, fandom, whether writers are still invested in it, and obviously they still are. Tell me your thoughts.
Well... West Allen just got married, and they already have a grown-ass child. So if you thought, like, marriage is going to make them boring, then think again, because they have a grown-ass daughter from the future. I think, like, this season has been Barry and Iris entering parenthood and how it changes them in their relationship. And so it's, like, good to see that as, like, a storyline for them and something that's interesting that keeps the ship fresh. I think as a ship, their relationship is solid. Narratively, they're not on the verge of collapse. There's no tension. Nora being alive only strengthens their bond because it means that they do reproduce in the future. So it is around to say the SS West Allen is a warship, and every single one of their fans will cut a bitch if necessary. So like the fandom involvement is super strong there. Narratively, fandom wise, it's solid. However, like as much as Nora's existence strengthens the longevity of the ship, I think her presence in season 5 has like slightly weakened the writer's focus on the ship. In my opinion, like I feel like the writers still love Barry and Iris, but as I mentioned like earlier, there are two ways to anchor a show, so the heart and the romance. And for like up until now, West Allen's been both of those. But I think season 5 has sought to like split the anchor and have like Barry and Nora be the heart, so the child is the heart while the wife is a romance. And overall, I think it makes for a slightly weaker connection. And what makes it worse is that for the first few episodes, rather than having the heart reinforce the love, Barry's heart anchor was in conflict with the romance. So Nora wasn't really getting along with Iris, and so that was causing a lot of strain on like the ship in the show narratively, I think. It just felt a little off just because Nora and Iris weren't getting along. And I feel like it's no coincidence that in this season, the Elseworlds episode and All Dolled Up both feel like the strongest episodes, at least for me, in the first half, because both the heart and the romance of the stories was between Barry and Iris. So Elseworlds was a West Allen-driven episode, and so was All Dolled Up. And those really felt really strong because, once again, like, the heart and the romance were aligned both in that one ship. On the other hand, you have, like, Iris, when she had, like, the reduced presence in the Hunters episode, and that episode relied fully on Barry, Nora, heart. It came off a little bit hollow for an episode that was supposed to be, like, a love letter to the fans and celebratory. And I feel like, a lot of people complained that Nora had 22 minutes of screen time, and a lot of it focused on Barry and Nora's relationship rather than all the other characters. And I feel like, people picked up on that because that heart anchor isn't as strong as, like, the 1-2 combo of West Allen, heart, and romance. And I feel like Ananda asked about the love languages with regards to West Allen. I think primarily, like, when you think about love language, it describes the way you like to receive displays of affection, and people often give affection in the ways they like to receive it. So, and this, Anon also mentioned the, or was it Renee? Was Renee the one that talked about the love languages? Was that her email?
I think yes. It might have been, yes.
Yeah. So, like, she mentions in her email, and I'd already written this down that I was going to bring it up, that back in season one, we noticed that between Barry and Iris, whenever Barry wants Iris' attention, he always says, like, look at me. Like, everything, like, when he really wants her attention, he, like, emphasizes it by telling her to look at him. And then he may also physically, like, place his hands in her face to hold her gaze. And then, Phantom, like, always talks about his, like, Caucasian caresses. Like, he likes to, like, touch your face. He likes to hold your hands. He likes to wipe non-existent tears away. He does all this stuff with his hands. So I feel like touch is definitely his primary love language. And I think it's also why if Iris is mad, like she was in 120, after she found out that Barry was a Flash and that he was lying to her, she withholds her touch. And he gets, like, hella confused and really sad because he does not understand what's going on. So I think that's another reason you can see, like, touch is really important to him. And when he doesn't get it, then he's like, "What? There's something wrong." And then his secondary love language is probably gift-giving because he's, like, super extra and over the top every time. He, like, gives, like, Christmas presents or, anything. He's always, like, extremely over the top. It's another way, like, he likes to show love. But then Iris, on the other hand, whenever she wants Barry's attention, she says, listen to me. So she likes to be heard. And she likes having, she likes hearing from Barry, like, Barry's opinions. And she likes having Barry's reassurance that he hears her. He understands her. So her secondary, that's her primary love language, I feel like, is words of affirmation. Yeah. And then I think her secondary is probably, like, acts of service, because I think she likes to do stuff for Barry. I think they both intimately understand the other, so a lot of the times Barry's, like, grand love gestures and speeches to Iris are him expressing words of affirmation to her, and then she often, like, reaches up to, like, hold his face or put her arms around his neck to reinforce what she's saying to him through touch, because she knows that he likes that. So, the end.
And what a beautiful end it was. I don't have anything really to add, but I guess I will attempt to add something, because otherwise I would just not speak, and that would be terrible. So, in terms of Barry and Iris as the anchor ship, I think that narratively they're stronger than they've ever been, given that they're married, they have a child, they back each other up on everything, they're partners who work in tandem to solve problems, but I do agree that from the point of view of a viewer, right, like, from the audience, we see that they get less focus as a couple than they did before. And Nora is the most salient, like, reason that we can see why. But I think that it's kind of, like, also playing into rule of television a little bit. Like, I think it was Joe that mentioned, or one of the feedbacks mentioned that, like, once the couple gets together officially, like, the peak romance is gone, and then, like, it's, like, downhill from there. So, like, that is 100% always the case, which is why usually the ship doesn't get married so early on in the show.
It's like the final season or something.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that that's a little bit part of it, but the fact that the writers still put so much effort into like having West Allen top themselves, even when overall we're not getting as many moments, shows that they're still invested in the ship. And I think that the biggest way that we see that that's still the case is, and that it's always been the case, is how the show progresses most effortlessly when big plot points turn with big West Allen moments, right? Like we've seen from the beginning, Barry's first time travel coincided with West Allen's first kiss. His first visit to a new Earth coincided with the resurgence of his romantic love for Iris via E2 Iris. The reveal of Savitar's plan coincided with, first off, the reason why it mattered to Barry was because Iris could die. And second off, it coincided with West Allen moving in together. So now that Nora is here, it's like they have to balance it, right? Because she's the reason why the plot is turning. Mm-hmm. But we still see that the big episodes then try to bring West Allen back together, except for 100th episode, which was felt off, right? Everyone agreed that it felt off because we didn't get that big West Allen moment, but they made up for it in the crossover, right? So I don't know. I would say it's a testament to West Allen's staying power that they still get as many big moments as they do this many seasons in while they're married and have a grown child who is taking up half of every episode. So yes, the fact that they still work it in is a good sign. And I totally agree with Jess about the love languages. Iris uses words of affirmation. Barry uses touch. And it's not like Barry doesn't love words of affirmation because he feeds off of validation. But in terms of romantic love, he uses touch. Mm-hmm. Like, he'll get pep talks from everyone and their mother, but touch is the thing that he reserves for Iris, really. So.
Yeah. I can't remember if Renee mentioned it. I was trying to, find her email. But I think she also picked up on the touch, because that's also, how it's connected to his powers. Mm-hmm. So whenever, he gets, first time that he has his powers, or, in 321, I think when he got amnesia, and then, the kiss.
It comes back with
activated his powers. Yeah. So that's also through touch. So, his love language is also, his power activation language. That's how connected their romance is with those speed
force. Yeah, I actually
had that in season 4. With when he said, "You're my lightning rod," I was still, so it's still been, it's still continuing.
Oh, it was you. It was you that I stole that from.
Yeah. Yes, I included that in my love language.
Spoilers.
I will get to spoilers.
This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it is a testament to, how much the writers still enjoy writing West Allen, that even in season 5, like you said, they're still giving them really romantic moments, like the dance scene we got in 5-5, and they always find each other no matter the universal reality trope in Elseworlds. And while it isn't as consistent as, season 3, where we got one thing every episode, I think they still managed to write the moments that feel very movie-esque and have worked this season to remind everyone that they're really ride or die for each other, like having Iris jump off a roof to save Barry, and Barry not caring he and Oliver switch places for a while until he realizes how that affects his relationship with Iris. And Barry has been really in tune to Iris's needs and feelings in season 5 so far, so I think that's strengthened as well. And he let her air out her pain about Nora and reassured her because he knew her doubts. And then Iris made him understand Nora's point of view, even when she struggled to understand why she was distant from her. And their trust in each other, whether it's their decisions or in the fact that they would save each other, has grown even stronger this season. And the two-way communication has definitely gotten better too, so that it's not just Barry getting to express his perspective, but Iris gets to do it far more often than before. And I think their foundation is still very, very stable, and they've been able to build on that very well. And the writers and the fandom still, their love still remains. So as a couple, they're pretty solid, and the writers don't seem interested in giving them internal drama, but they still keep it interesting by giving them an adult daughter to deal with. And I do think this season has lessened the one-on-one talks between Barry and Iris now that they're more sporadic. And I agree with Jess that they've tried to have that between Barry and Nora instead, and on a couple of occasions to have it between Iris and Nora as well, so they've kind of split it. And that, I agree that's why the 100th episode fell flat, because there was too much Barry and Nora. And even though Nora is their daughter as a character, she still doesn't have the same foundation with her parents that they have with each other. because she's still very new. So by shifting some of that focus onto her, most especially in episodes that focus her, the lack of heart really starts to show. But, you know, obviously despite that, they're still able to drive stories, and the writers still view them as the gold standard. And as for their love language, which Jessica already previewed, I also agree that touch is their love language. So even when they don't have major scenes together, Barry's like always rubbing Iris's back or her arm, cradling her face, holding her hand. And Iris is honestly more, to me, is like a cuddler or like a hugger, because it was usually like leaning in to initiate hugs, or also constantly leaning into his side or wrapping her arm around him, sitting on his lap. You know, her legs are like always over his knees when she's doing that, so that she's closer to him as well. And then touch is also their love language when it comes to Barry's powers, like we saw in like the pilot, 4-1, 4-10. So they're like literal extensions of their love activating his powers. And I think Barry is more so the instigator when it comes to touching a lot of the time, whereas Iris tends to use her voice, like you guys mentioned, more often to convey love or what she wants. Like, she uses endearments, whereas Barry only ever called her by her name. And she tells him to kiss her out loud sometimes, and she also uses her voice to get him to listen to her advice and, like, bring him out of something, like she did in 221 or, like, with the Grodd episode, and then 321 as well when he, you know, after his amnesia ended. And I would also add that the way that they use their eyes as another form of love language, because it's something that they're both equally good at using when they aren't, when there aren't any words between them.
Her eyes, motherfucker.
Yes. Very much. All right, moving on to our submarine ship, or our beta ship. There was mainly Joe Cecile, but how do we feel about Joe Cecile as a beta ship on The Flash?
I feel like the last time that we did an episode for the series, I said that I didn't feel like Joe Cecile was a true, like, beta submarine ship to West Allen, and I still don't. Even though, like, they have a child of their own this season, so it's, like, new parents of a child, new parents of a child. There haven't really been many attempts to, like, parallel the two or have Joe Cecile as a ship prop up West Allen on what it means to be, like, new parents. So, I mean, partly it could be due to Jesse's injury, but I feel like even with the healthy Jocelyn, there's not really a lot to parallel, because I feel like subships should parallel up to the anchor, and Jocelyn are older and wiser than West Allen, so it's like, you know, there's not a lot for Jocelyn to learn from Barry and Iris, which I think a subship should do. So I think, like, the best potential, now that Senko is gone, and they're never going to do Killer Vibe, the best potential for a beta ship this season, if they do it right, will most likely be Ralph and Sue. Because one, I think the writers are clearly invested in Ralph. Season 4 shows how much they love Ralph and the fact that they brought him back and made him a regular this season. He has enough general audience fans, I think, and a strong comic canon love interest in Sue to win over enough fan support for it to be a supported ship. And then if the ship is written with a strong foundation, then I think it will be, like, the new beta ship for the show. And I think Ralph Sue is a much easier ship to parallel to West Allen because, like, Ralph practically worships Barry and Iris anyway and their healthy relationship. So I feel like we don't know if Sue was, like, an old love or a new love. But either way, I feel like Ralph would want to kind of emulate the same love that Barry and Iris has in his relationship with Sue. And I think that's how that they'll play that out.
So while I agree that an attempt was made to make Jocelyn the submarine ship, and then it quickly fell apart, whether it's because of JLM or because of they just don't care, I still think that the most paralleled ship, like the closest to a submarine ship on The Flash, and the one that has most paralleled West Allen throughout the run of the show, despite never being an actual ship, is Caitlin and Sisko. And this season, their friendship has come back to the forefront. Sisko helps Caitlin with her family issues, which parallels Barry supporting Iris through their daughter issues. And, you know, they make it very clear that there's no one who loves Caitlin more than Sisko. And I would say that in season 1 and even season 2, there was, like, much stronger parallels. Like, even they would, like, have visually similar scenes. Like, that I always remember from 103 when it's, like, starts off with Barry and Iris going on their little friend date, and they're, like, walking down the street eating, And, like, it ends with Caitlin and Cisco going on their little date, and they're eating their ice cream. And I was like, this is super the same. but, yeah. So I think they would make the strongest submarine ship on the show if they ever went there for real. But for now, it's helping to anchor Caitlin's storyline. Like, it makes Caitlin's storyline better that Cisco is there pushing her through it, just like Iris and Barry are there for each other in the other side of things. Meanwhile, I agree that Ralph and Sue is the most likely canonical ship for a submarine, the most likely submarine candidate for the future whenever she arrives. But I think it's going to be a little weak, just mostly because it didn't exist before season 5 and Ralph didn't exist before season 4. So, like, it's not hard-coded in the DNA. Even Joe and Cecile, like, Cecile was around in season 1. So, like, they have something to draw back on, even though they obviously don't care. But anyway, on the flip side, because Ralph is a white man, as previously mentioned, and because it'll be, like, these new writers' chance to make their mark, it's possible that they'll put more investment, because it'll be, like, their ship.
Yeah.
But given how they downgraded Ralph already this season, after the disastrous attempt to make him the new star of the show last year, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see, like, where they fall in the little range of it, right? How much are they going to try to take up space with Ralph and Sue, or how much will they really put into it when they've got the whole West Island family to deal with? Finally, my last point will just be that Joe and Cecile is out of the running because of JLM's injury, but the fact that they didn't write around it, because in any other, like, in other shows or other moments when you really care about a ship, even if you don't have that actor, you will call back to it. You will have, like, even Cisco and Cynthia is getting a little bit more, what with Cisco every episode, you know, either drinking because of Cynthia or telling people he's over Cynthia when nobody asked. whereas sometimes we don't even know what Joe's doing. Just like, ah, he's out on a walk with his child. Okay, sure. So, yeah.
I remember when they said they were going to explain his absence. I was like, that's how they're going to explain his absence.
He's out on a walk and never came back.
Exactly.
He went out for milk and he never came back.
So, yeah. So, that's that on that, May.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. With, like, where the Flash succeed with regards to their anchor ship, they generally fail with their beta ships. And Joe and Cecile are a good and cute couple, but they've never really paralleled Barry and Iris at all. And I also thought they'd use Cecile to help West Island in the parenthood department, like you guys already mentioned. But we haven't really gotten much of that. And even with Jesse on medical leave, they haven't given Cecile and Iris anything to discuss motherhood or anything like that. But instead, Cecile was talking it out with Nora and not paralleling her experiences with Iris instead. And I guess they could have brought on another love interest for Cisco and developed that, but the writers don't seem interested in Cisco enough to give him someone else to love. So I suppose next on the list is Ralph and Sue, because that makes sense given their comic book history. But like Tati mentioned, right now, Ralph and Sue being a beta ship is odd to me because they haven't focused on Ralph at all in 5A. Like, he's there and he has, like, comedic beats and everything like that, but they'd have to, like, justify shifting the focus back to him in 5B, unless they're, like, replacing him with, you know, replacing Caitlin's story with him instead. And I also think the writers possibly wanting to get Ralph and Caitlin together at the start of the season before that was shot down might have had them be a beta ship for a while, but that never happened, so it doesn't exist. Crack ship corner. Who are our Flash crack ships and why?
Woo! Well, I added this because I think one of Anon's asked us if we could do, like, an episode on crack shipping. I don't really know how you can do, like, a full episode because crack ship is, like, a choose-your-own-adventure game. So, but I think we, like, all have, like, crack ships that we like. So in the crack ship corner for the Flash, all of mine usually involve Iris because I love her, and so why shouldn't several other people? So, like, Cold West, Girder, Tony and Iris, and then Super West are, like, probably my top three. I'm probably the only one person shipping Tony and Iris in my little, you know, lifesaver raft. But, like, you know, there is basic, like, So my formula for crack shipping, there is a basis for this, because he clearly had a crush on her, first of all. And then he did get redeemed before he died. But he did get redeemed. So there was like room for him to like grow. And I think he could have been like a cute like frenemy for Barry and a flirt man's for Iris. So like he would do stuff for Iris, even though he was like not in like a rivalry with Barry or whatever, if they hadn't have killed him off. So I feel like they killed him off prematurely. And I think that Tawny, Iris, and Barry would have been 100 times better triangle than Eddie, Iris, and Barry, just because, like, Tawny would, like, match Barry in pettiness, whereas Eddie was a little bit, like, bland, like, no seasoning. Tawny would have made it a little spicy. Tawny would have made it a little bit spicier. So, like, that was one. And then Cold West, I liked because it has comic canon of Leonard being enamored with Iris to back it up. And I feel like, especially in season one, it was just like a Barry love fest. So even like comic canon villains that had like a crush on Iris, like Leonard Snart, Eobard, all of that was kind of like wiped away. And I felt like it was, you know, it was just like missing what you could have like mined so much from that. And then Wentworth and Candace had like a really nice on-screen chemistry together. Lynn was clearly a fan of her prose writing, and so like I feel like they could have just pulled their heads out of Barry's ass. We could have had it all. We could have had it all. And then finally, like Super West, because they're just super cute. And Kara is just literally like the female version of Barry. So I feel like of all the women of the Arrowverse, Iris would like most likely go for Kara, with Felicity being a very close second.
Yes, I accept these things, and I would totally watch a Super West show. Just journalist girlfriends.
Yes.
Superheroing on the side. But oh well, alas. I just talked about Caitlin Sisko and how it's my belief. I believe I make it the submarine ship, but it is also my biggest fandom ship. So yes, I'm like, oh, that's my crack ship, I guess, since apparently it would be two flowers in the attic to happen in real life. I also think that Nora and Spencer has a lot of potential for some fun push and pull hero villain dynamics, like Sisko and Lisa had for the 2 seconds that they had it, and that people constantly see in Barry and Len, but that the show never really did anything with, because then they set him in Legends, and then he died. So, yes, give me more Nora and Spencer. I think she's coming back for an episode, so yeah. Come back for more episodes! Do the thing! Also, like Jessica, I will ship Iris with any reasonable person who isn't Caitlin. So, there's no one I don't ship Iris with, except for Caitlin. But while crack shipping, it's hard for me to like really visualize a ship that interferes with my canon ones. So it's not like I'm actively like, oh man, let's put Iris with these people. But my favorites for her would be Linda and Sisko, all in Flash itself. But if we're talking about, you know, the larger universe, the ones that Jessica pointed out are excellent ones.
I definitely agree with Cold West, because it's fun, because the 2 seconds of, like, tense banter between Iris and Snart was great, and they managed to have chemistry for like, that one moment that they interacted. Killer Vibe is another, because they're super close, and they have a lot of big moments, but the writers sadly never want to make them take off in season one. But like Tati said, in general, like, Flash is hard to crack ship for me when it comes to either Barry or Iris, just because it's, like, so strong of a foundation, I can't imagine them with other people. yeah.
I don't crack ship Barry ever.
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, no.
For me, that one I just can't do.
Mm-mm.
But final thoughts on the Flash, naughty or nice? Are they going to get Cole or a nice gift?
I'd say that they are mostly nice. I'll give them a small gift. Well, a medium-sized gift. They haven't done any integral damage to their flagship, which is great. And now that Nora has like made up with her mother, there's no weird tension there. So I feel like it could only get, well, it's not going to get better because Nora's working with Eobard. But for like one brief moment, it'll probably be really good. And then I feel like when that secret partnership is revealed, the fallout will, at least for a moment, weaken the Barry and Nora heart anger side and like reconsolidate the heart and the romance within Barry and Iris, and I think that's where their strong suit is. And so, yeah.
I am going to say that it is nice. I think that, you know, no DC TV show has been nicer to its anchorship, in my personal opinion, or more consistent with its anchorship, given that we are on season 5 and it hasn't changed once. And I don't think any other show in DC TV can say that. So, nice.
That is very true. And that's why, you know, comparing them to anybody else is just hard. You can't do that. Flash is nice this year because West Allen is still perceived as a top-tier relationship that makes everyone question why theirs isn't as good. And also because, like, their foundation is still very strong and their communication even better. And then, like Jess said, with Nora basically set up to break her parents' hearts in 5B, they'll become, like, more central as a couple and team unit now that the conflict with their daughter is going to be, like, with both of them and not just with one parent.
Yeah.
Agreed. That's what I'm excited for.
United front against their child.
Yeah.
Moving on to our middle child, Supergirl, who struggles with an anchorship, but is currently probably Guardian Corps. So,
it's not. They don't have one.
They don't really have one. They're floating in the middle of the sea. They haven't left. They haven't left shore. So, what do we think about Supergirl not having an anchorship?
All right. So, focusing solely on an update since the last time that we checked in, which was the end of season 3, I think that Kara is really adrift when it comes to romantic love. We already know that Mon-El was a waste of space. He was a literal anchor that sunk Kara's individual storyline. So I don't regret that they let him go, especially because I never felt like his romance was ever Kara's story. But it's still a shame that Kara doesn't have an alpha/anchor ship to call her own. She and Alex are 100% the most important relationship of the show, and it's a beautiful relationship, and it serves the purpose of the anchorship, or I guess we can call it the heart. Yeah. As Jess pointed out, it serves as the heart of the show. But we have already seen in action how a romantic relationship takes away from their heart, takes away from their screen time together. So when Alex and Maggie were together, there would be several episodes where Alex was sectioned off with her instead and had either no or minimal interaction with Kara. And similarly, when Kara was with Mon-El, she had less time with Alex, and people even noticed that and complained about it. So since we know that Alex is getting another ship, you know, in 2019, Kara still has Bupkis, it's going to be Kara who suffers. She's going to be the one that doesn't have Alex to go to with her problems, and she already doesn't have Lena to go to with her problems because Lena is busy with her romance. So given the way that the Supergirl writers have been writing these women or writing all their characters in general, it's a disadvantage to Kara not to have a romance, like 100%. It doesn't help. It doesn't increase her narrative or her independence or her anything. It just decreases her screen time and her interactions. Speaking of which, we're going to talk more about this in other sections, but Lena and Kara were such a prevalent relationship back in season 2, and then that way in which she got her ship, and again, Kara is the one that doesn't get development because of it. Lena still gets development. She gets development with Guardian Corps, whether or not you like it is a different story, and then she gets her own development outside of that with her business or with her, like, dual dark side or whatever you want to talk about it. The only thing that she doesn't get is scenes with her supposed best friend. Finally, I know that other people will be putting Caradox in the potential for anchorship, but I am not because, I mean, right now the writers have given me zero indication that they want to go that route, whether or not it's comic book canon. And I think the fact that they haven't even put hints in it is just a sign of how little they care about Kara in romantically speaking. Which, again, would be fine. Women don't need romance if they gave her something substantial to make up for it. Which they do not. All right.
I don't know that I fully agree with that, because I know that you like something else, and I don't think, I feel like they have put about as much effort into Caradox as they have into Brainia. But we'll talk about that later. But for me, like, what's interesting about Supergirl is that
the fact that it doesn't have, like, an anchorship for the show. So, like, the heart of the show is the relationship between Kara and Alex, and that's what they're using, because they don't have a romantic pair for Kara. And then I feel like, going back to, I guess it was Joe, when she was saying, you know, why are Barry and Oliver allowed to have all of these love interests, and Kara's just kind of, like, on a lonely island by herself. And I feel like if she was a man, she probably would have moved on to another love interest by now. And I think that she would have had one for the first part of season three, instead of, like, moping about Mon-El being gone. She probably would have had that for, like, one or two episodes, and then she would have been reintroduced to another love interest, at least until Mon-El returned from wherever he, like, yeeted off to into space. Like, when he came back, then that would become the new love story. So I feel like she doesn't necessarily, like Tati says, she doesn't necessarily have to date or have her life revolve around love, but I do think, like, there is this stigma in society that women can't have it all that doesn't apply to the men. So women can't have love and career and be strong and all this, but men are allowed to do that. They can have girlfriends, even if they're, like, lying to them, keeping them in the dark, while they go off and save the world and figure their shit out. But Kara can't. And so if you compare, even if you compare, like, Kara to Sarah, I largely think that Sarah is or was written more like a male protagonist. Like, I feel like Guggenheim just, like, modeled her into literally female Oliver so that he could write her, he could write himself through her. And that's why she got a lot of, like, random sporadic interest, love interest. And we'll talk about that more in Legends. But Kara is kind of different from that. And, like, the only romance the writers actually gave any effort for her was fundamentally flawed in how they wrote Mon-El and how Kara always had to come down to him rather than him improving himself to be worthy of her and coming, like, up to her level. She had to always come down to his. I think it was written from a male perspective, even though Kara is the heroine, so it's kind of, like, backwards. And then in the post, like, AJK era, the writers seem to be trying to overcorrect from Caramel, in my opinion. Like, first they retconned him in season three, and now they're just, like, ignoring romance completely for her. And she's not even, like, bringing it up as to, like, you know, it's been a while, or, you know, it's not even, like, coming up on a radar as, like, a possible story. Even though they've introduced, like, a major comic canon love interest in Brainiac. Like, if you introduce him to the show, like, why wouldn't you do that? And it's, what's crazy to me is that the network clearly ships it. Like, they always promote Melissa and Jesse together. And this is even before the season four premieres. Like, the season four premiere promotion was all Melissa and Jesse, Kara and Brainy, doing promos together. The recent Christmas holiday promotion was Melissa and Jesse. So, you know, the network wants it to happen, I feel like. Brainy is wildly popular within the fan base. So there's a fan, and there's a fan base comic and on the show that wants to see them together. So the only question that I have is why the writers don't seem to want to pull the trigger on it. And I feel like there's a lot of, like, they have a lot of, like, really cute moments and a lot of moments where they pair up really nicely. And I feel like, yeah, I don't know what the issue is about it. And then I guess we'll keep talking about it in the other sections, but go ahead, May.
All right, yeah. Well, so while Kara and Alex anchor the show, like you guys said, and their relationship has always been at the heart of it, Kara's romantic life has been all over the place from the beginning. I definitely think if Kara were a man, she'd have had other love interests. Like, 3A would have been the part of the season where she got her own version of Patty, like the male version of Patty, before Mon-El pops back into the second half of the season and they can just, you know, have something there. Instead, they wrote Kara like she was the one being pursued instead of the one driving her own story when it came to Mon-El versus the way it was with James in season one. And then the show had her caped in, like, his sexist ways, which was really frustrating. And then he wasn't really helping her grow, so even trying to reboot their romance was a mistake. And then at the very beginning, they worked really hard to try and be like Flash season one with the way Kara was acting towards James. But I think they really ruined any romantic prospects for her by trying to make Mon-El her OTP and then making him the one longing for her in 3B while she looked like she was over it at that point. And now it really seems like they've dropped any hope or interest in writing for Kara romantically, even though she finally has one of her comic book love interests on the show, like you guys said. Like, in narrative, though it doesn't seem like the writers want to go there. And they seem, they do, for me, they seem far more interested in Nia and Brainy because they've already given them, like, more bigger moments indicating that it could become romantic. And I think any other ship will always be a bit weak because as the main character, it's Kara who should be setting the romantic example. But the writers don't even seem to want, like, random guys flirting with her, much less trying to write her into a relationship. But I'd argue that Kara has the most chemistry with women, and that really shows in her scenes with literally every single woman who's appeared on the show. Like, that's where her strengths lie and why depriving her of interaction with women hinders her growth, whether they ever choose to invest in a romantic relationship or not. And still, the writers have a tendency to think that they can only portray, you know, strong women when they're not in a relationship, and that's a disservice to Kara's character in general. Submarine ship. This is Guardian Corps.
There we go.
Yes. What are our thoughts on Guardian Corps, and do we think another beta ship could rise in place of them?
Rise, beta ship. I think that Guardian Corps was a pretty strong submarine ship last year. And somehow, for some reason, this season proved that the writers just aren't in it for the long haul. So I don't know. It might be that it's suffering from, you know, lack of anchor ship syndrome, that, like, it doesn't have a ship to be propping or to be paralleling, and so it's just kind of, like, floating out on its own, and it's not strong enough to be an anchor ship, so it's just kind of being blown away buffeted by the winds of fate, if you will. Or it could just be that it's because of James and the way that they write James, and they don't care about James, and they put the plot over him all the time. I don't know, because, like, as much as Mon-El was waning fast last year, there was still the ghost of Kara's heartbreak to pit against Lena's blossoming romance. And now it's just, you know, James being a tool for the plot. So in season two, he was Guardian, even though that didn't make any sense because he was already a hero as a photojournalist, but apparently he was not anymore. He could only be Guardian. And then in season three, they were like, who's Guardian? I don't know her. And suddenly he was just, like, Lena's right-hand man and, like, her new best friend, and also, you know, clashing at work, and then new love of her life, etc. And then in season four, he's kumbayaing with Nazis for unknown reasons. And the problem is that last one clashes with what Lena is doing, which makes the relationship suffer, even though they had no reason to be at odds before he suddenly decided that maybe racists have a point. So I think that they're probably going to, maybe they won't break them up, but they're definitely, like, they've lost the fire that they had for them last season. So hopefully Alex's new lady can become the submarine ship, if only because Alex is Kara's most important relationship, and that might inspire them to give Kara someone so that she can parallel Alex. Because as Jessica pointed out earlier, it's weird that the most important relationship is Kara and Alex, followed by Alex and John. The second most important relationship should be Kara and someone, not Alex and someone. But here we are. So, if they're going to make the third most important relationship be Alex and someone else, then maybe, finally, some of that will bounce back onto Kara and let her have a relationship, or, you know, at least give her scenes where they can parallel, like, why is this working for me and why is this not working for you, Kara? Something that will lead to personal development for her.
Yeah, and I feel like if I agree that I think that Alex and whoever her new love interest is, because I think one of the nons mentioned that Kyler said that this next love interest is going to be, like, long-term, as what the plan is. So I would hope that that would become the beta ship and Kara has, like, a romantic anchor. So with Kara and Alex being the heart and their romances being, like, parallel to each other, this, again, like, the heart is reinforcing, like, the romance. So you have, like, a stronger show if you do it that way. But Guardian Corps ain't it. Like, this ship took some major hits in the first half of season four. I feel like season three, the rise of them of Guardian Corps seemed to be, like, the only thing keeping the show grounded in the sense that, you know, Kara didn't really have a strong romantic anchor with Caramel, but the anchorship that they did have wasn't really working on all cylinders. And she didn't have her heart anchor with Alex because Alex was dealing with Sandra stuff. So you know, Lena's relationship with James really moved the narrative, and we even talked about how much it seemed like Lena's show in season 3 instead of Kara's, because Lena was, like, the focal point of all the plot points, and, like, the major plot points in that season. But this season, for whatever reason, the writers have just stopped giving a shit about James and his individual arc. And it's not only hurt him as a character, but it's also seriously, like, damaged the ship, like, major holes in the ship. I guess Lena could share some of the blame as well for lying about helping James get out of jail without his knowledge or permission. But at least I understand her motivations for doing that. Like, her motivations within her ship, it makes sense. Even though she's doing something wrong, there's a motivation behind it. And that motivation makes sense. Like, she's grown up mostly alone. She's not had a lot of friends or loved ones, the people that care about her. She's always afraid of being alone or letting someone in, and lest they, like, leave her or they die or something like that. She's always afraid to, like, open up. And so she finally has that with James. And now there's a possibility that he could leave her by, like, going to jail. And so, you know, possibly losing him, I understand why she felt like she had to do what she did. I know what James means to her. I don't know what Lena means to James. Like, he seems ready to throw away their relationship at a moment's notice. He was really hesitant and dragged his feet a lot late in the season 3. Like, he was the main, like, resistance to that ship even getting off the ground in season 3 as well. And then in season 4, like, he just, like, goes forward whatever he wants to do. He wants to talk to Nazis. He doesn't really care about her opinion unless it's aligned with his opinion and what he's planning on doing anyway. So, like, even in, like, his Come to Jesus moment episode and, like, episode 7, it didn't really seem very earned because he didn't seem like he learned anything. And there's this, like, false equivalency which they try to make with him and the Children of Liberty and Kara Manchester. So it just didn't really feel like an earned story at all. So I think, again, like, once Alex's new love interest gets introduced, the writers clearly have a lot of investment and they like Alex. And so I feel like that will take over as the submarine ship. And then hopefully it appeals to the fans as well. So I think it will appeal to the writers. And then they can have that. And the anchor ship I want is Cardox, because I feel like she deserves her anchor ship. And then they can use Kara and Alex to reinforce the romantic parallels between Alex's ship and Kara's.
Yeah, I had a lot of hope for Guardian Coral going into the season because it finally seemed like they had found some solid ground at the end of season 3. But I agree that the ultimate failure for Guardian Corps is that James is a weak and wishy-washy character from the writer's perspective anyway. Like, that's how they write him. And if the writers cared about him as a person as much as they seem to care about Lena, then they'd definitely be more invested in the ship. But James's views on Agent Liberty blew a large hole in the ship, and by the mid-season finale, I wasn't convinced that they could ever go back to being on the same page as before, not with their opposing ideologies and failure to communicate. So in 4B, I think the beta ship will either become Nia and Brainy, or whoever they pair Alex with. Either way, they will never truly set sail without an anchor ship to guide their way, and I hope Kara gets one so that she can get some focus, and so that others who are in relationships won't abandon her and leave her behind while they go and live their merry lives. Crack ship corner. Do we have a crack ship for Supergirl?
As already mentioned, I do indeed have a crack ship for Supergirl. It will come as no surprise that I ship Brainy and Nia, and it is a crack ship because it is not canon, but I would argue that it has a stronger foundation off which to build than Kara and Brainy do. However, I don't post it as a contender for a submarine ship because I'm a coward and I don't like being wrong. So I would, you know. But Brainy is the easiest option if they wanted to write in a ship for Kara as the anchor romance. And obviously, the submarine ship cannot be in direct conflict with the anchor ship. So that would be dumb of them to do if they ever decide to switch lanes. The other big one, which is a big crack ship, is Supercorp. They had the perfect opening to be a ship in season 2, and I think that they could easily get the ball rolling again once Lena finds out the truth, because that would put them on more equal footing. Kara would have to regain her trust. They might even actually have to have scenes in order for trust to be regained. That would be incredible. But I don't expect the show to ever do it. even though they would have a wealth of storytelling options if they ever decided to.
Yes. And I feel like, and May is probably on your side, I feel like we're on like opposite sides of the spectrum, like behind our podiums with like 7-slide PowerPoint presentation. Like, aww, in this presentation, I don't know why Brittany and Carr need to be together. like, obviously, I guess I'm not opposed to Brittany and Nia. I think if they do happen, then, like, obviously it'll be cute. But I can't lie that I wouldn't feel some kind of way about it. And the reason why is because, you know, like I said, like, Brittany is a comic canon love interest for Kara. And why introduce him to the show if you're not going to do anything with it? And I feel like, again, it goes back to what Joe was asking about, you know, with Kara being a woman and not getting the things in love that she should get compared to her male counterparts. And I feel like, you know, you can't say that you wouldn't feel some kind of way, like on The Flash, for example, in season one, if they had introduced Wally in season one, but still had Barry date Linda anyway, you would feel some kind of way about it, because that's...
I mean, Linda, I still feel like, some kind of way about the fact that Barry dated Linda, even though Wally wasn't there. Yeah,
he wasn't
of course.
So still felt some kind of way about it. Right. And so
I feel some kind of way for the reason that you said, like, first off, because Kara should get the romance, because we should see that women can have it all. Yeah. And second off, because, you know, they introduced another man of color, and then they were like, but we're not going to put him with Kara. Right. We're going to put him with this random woman. Which, you know, I agree with. I'm only speaking from the fact that I feel like what they've written so far is Brandy and Nia. And I'm happy to ship it because I'm not invested in any romance for Kara because they haven't given me a reason to be.
you know, again, you can, like, blame it on the AJK era or not. And I do feel like they're trying to overcorrect and, like, make sure, like, everyone is, you know, forgets about Mon-El for a season before they try again. But I feel like if they did Brainy and Nia first, then it's kind of makes it a little bit, I mean, it happens in TV all the time where, like, friends all interdate, you know, Grey's Anatomy, and everyone's just, like, having sex with everybody else. but it would feel a little weird to me. And I think that not putting Kara and Brainy together when Kara's obviously available and Brainy's also obviously available to me would just feel like one more thing that they're taking away from Kara. And I feel like you can make, there's a lot of arguments. I think on Nia's side, it's very obvious that she has at least like a crush on Brainy. But I think there's also like an argument to be made with Kara and Brainy and how much they have in common, how much he, you know, cares about her. Like you brought up Streaky, her cat, and he was like worried about her and like their movies and how well they work together. So I feel like you could make arguments on both sides, but the writers don't seem in a rush to pull the trigger on either. But crack shipping, getting back around to that, I don't really necessarily have a crack ship for Supergirl other than Supercore, because I agree with you that there is a lot there, and there's a lot that they are even paralleling, I think, West Allen with back in season two. And there's a lot of, like, a lot of the moments that they had, and then I feel like Supergirl is just super conservative with Kara, and not wanting to open her up. Like, I feel like she could be pansexual, because I feel like aliens shouldn't have these, like, strict, you know, heterosexual-only kind of, like,
lanes. Yeah, there should be at least one alien that's popped up with that.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, Kara should be open to more than just heterosexual ships, but they don't seem to really want to go there. So for now, it's just, like, it's the largest fandom ship of a non-canon ship, I think, in the DCTV universe.
Brainy and Nia, for me, because like Tati said, in the narrative, like, that's what it seems like that they want or could do. But, you know, I feel like they could also make them friends and, you know, they won't care either way. And, but it would be cute to see them. It would also be lovely to see them develop Kara in a relationship, so... Just open that door, writer, so we'll be ready to ship it. We'll be ready. And as far as Supercore, like, it was the best in season two. But now, since they barely have any scenes together, so any major investment in them that I ever had has kind of waned. So, like, until they try to give them more scenes and all of that, I can crack ship it again. Naughty or nice for Supergirl?
Haha. I'm going to give it naughty. It's going to get some coal in its stocking because they keep messing around with their ships, changing their minds about which foot to put first, and leaving their heroine with no longevity in her love life while failing to supplement the deaths of the alpha ship with an addictive beta one. So none for Gretchen Wieners.
Yeah, I am also going to say naughty because they're dragging their feet on giving us some kind of relief from Guardian Corps. Because that's their only ship that they have right now, and they're imploding it willingly. They're doing self-suicide. Well, suicide is always self, but they're blowing up their own ship over nonsense, and they have nothing else to replace that with or fill that void. So, yeah. Stop dragging your feet on Cardox, please.
Yeah, definitely naughty because of their romantic, the lack of the romantic direction and their terrible handling of basically all of Kara's ships. And also for trying to throw James and Lena's relationship like out the window so quickly. Like we got maybe 3 episodes in, they're already having issues. I think that was ridiculous. Moving into our problem child, Arrow. Anchor ship, Elicity. What are our thoughts about that? And how we feel like the writer's investment in them, whether it's changed. I know fandom is still huge.
Yeah, like Elicity, if we're comparing ships terminology, I don't even know if, like, I think, like, Elicity is an old warhorse, and I don't know if that's a ship terminology, but that's what they are. They have, like, this really loyal fandom with, like, a hair trigger, so their fandom is also huge and also will ride or die for them. But, like, their foundation is super shaky, seeing as how it was never supposed to exist in the first place, and the writers seem to have a love-hate relationship with it. When they love it, Felicity as an individual seems to disappear a little bit within the ship and then also within, like, the team dynamic. And then when they hate it, like, Oliver's just an asshole. So either way, like, somebody is suffering on, like, one end or the other. And I think traditionally Arrow's anchors have always been split with maybe OTA or previously Thea carrying the heart and then Elicity carrying, like, the romance. However, in season 5, once she introduced, like, Prometheus in that storyline and William came back to the forefront, William has been, like, Oliver's heart anchor and the relationship that has driven all of Oliver's decisions and how he views himself as a hero. And then his relationship with Felicity seems to be built more around her ability to be a surrogate mother to William. So the romance anchor is subordinate to the heart anchor in this regard. And then in season 7, the writers appear to reach, like, a balance, I guess, in how they want to write the ship. But the gag is they can only write Elicity as a love story if they're separated for 7 episodes. So, like, Felicity is getting a lot of focus and story, but it's a story that's leading her down, like, a really negative path. And she's presumed in the future not only to be a bad guy, but also dead. In the future, Oliver's also dead. Their son hates both of them because, according to him, they abandoned him a long time ago, and William is supposed to be, like, the heart. So if the heart doesn't believe in the OTP, like, what does that mean for your OTP? Like, that's not very encouraging. Their future seems to be, like, super depressing, to be honest, and not the happy one that I'm sure, like, their fans are really, like, probably hoping for. A lot of that is probably misdirect, but it's still kind of a weird place to place your anchor ship in. And then on top of that, Oliver's, like, backsliding to season 1 Oliver during the crossover. So, like, my biggest problem with him in the crossover was his inability to give Felicity the consideration of being his partner. And there was, like, absolutely zero sense for him to want to keep Felicity in the dark about them switching. Especially because he just learned in the episode before, on The Flash, how that was affecting his wife. Like, how keeping secrets and not consulting his wife was affecting him. Like, I literally straight up told you, your wife called me on the phone and was complaining that you went off to jail without consulting her. And he heard that, and it was, like, surprising to him. And then all of a sudden in Arrow, he still wants to keep her in the dark. So, it doesn't really seem like you learned a lot in that one episode. Like, he had a perfectly good example with Barry and Iris on the right way to communicate with your spouse. So if he knows he's in trouble for lying, like, why would you lie some more? Like, that doesn't really make sense to me. And the fact that he has issues with Felicity around this is exactly the reason, like, the excuse he gave of not telling her was because they had enough problems. But the fact that you have problems is the exact reason why he should have told her. And if they, the writers can't, like, either they can't or they won't fix his character flaw, and they can't or they won't progress Oliver as a man and as a husband, like, what is the point? Like, what are you working towards if you don't want to fix your protagonist? Like, I don't get it.
It's no surprise that I basically agree with you, Jessica. The crossover episodes of Flash and Arrow, which Guggenheim approved of and which Schwartz reinforced in previous episodes of this season of Arrow, directly pitted Elicity against West Allen, and it was in a very unflattering way. Which I guess you could argue that last season's crossover was too, but at least in that one, it was resolved in a more, I don't know, I guess they did a better job of resolving it.
I feel like it was supposed to be, like, resolved, like, I feel like it was supposed to feel as though it was resolved on a positive note since they got married.
Yeah, exactly. But even when they're getting married, it's like, oh, we can't compete with their vows.
Right.
Even though we're going to try anyway. So, it's a little bit weird. Like, why would you pit your own ship against a different ship in a negative light? Even if you're then eating up all the screen time / storyline. So it's like, you're kind of saying you're better because you're taking all the space, but what you're presenting is not better. So I don't know. It's weird. But even though their storyline ended with Oliver promising he'd love Felicity no matter what, the lead up to that had him refusing to trust her with the exact same secret that he was giving away like Halloween candy to everyone else. And there was like no real reason why. It was just like, oh, we're already on, you know, rocky right now. So it's just going to be even rockier, I guess, if I tell her more truths, even though not telling truths is the reason that we're rocky, but whatever. And also the fact that he questioned her darkness in the first place, when he himself has thrived on his own darkness for like 7 years, is already a problem. Like, you should never be in a position where your, you know, male lead, where your romantic hero is like, oh, I don't know if I can love this version of you, right? That should never be in question, because romantic love, or just love in general, is supposed to be unconditional. And of course, it's not in real life, right? It's often not. You often put conditions. But when you write it in a narrative, it has to be conditional. It has to be unconditional, or else you can always write yourself into a condition where you can't have your ship together anymore, and you don't want to do that. So yeah, that's like a red flag for me. Anyway, obviously I do believe writers will continue with Elicity. I don't think they're going to switch to, like, people constantly ask me like, oh, well, do you think this means that there's a shot for like Oliver and Earth 2 Laurel? There's not.
No.
There's not. If there was, it would have happened now. It's not. It's not happening. They're going to stay with Elicity. And I'm sure that, you know, even in the future where Felicity is dead, she will either soon be undead, not a zombie, but like not dead anymore, or she and Oliver will both be dead and the show will be over, so it won't matter. But I don't think that they're going to like veer from this path, but I do think that there always feels like there's some kind of hesitation built in on the part of the writers. And like Jessica's mentioned, it stems back to season one. And the fact the ship wasn't meant to happen, it wasn't hard-coded into the DNA of the show. So anytime, like, you know, the pilot is like the Bible of a show. So you can veer off as much as you want, as long as you can find justification for it in the pilot. Like, that's usually how writers, like, of a TV show long form feel. Because otherwise you'd be lost at sea if you don't have anything to tie back to. And Felicity didn't even exist as a character in the pilot, which means that when they're like trying to figure out where they're going to go or how far they can branch out, they don't know how far to branch out from, because the person in the pilot was Laurel and not Felicity. Mm-hmm. And not that this means that you can't write a show where you do that. Like, obviously it's happened before successfully, and obviously Felicity has generated a huge fan base, but it does feel like they dove in to the ship on the basis of the chemistry, and they didn't plan out for themselves. They didn't rewrite a planned show with Felicity in mind.
Yeah.
So that's why they're a little bit lost sometimes. And they don't know how they want this love to inform Oliver's journey. Like, that's another thing, too. Like, in the 100th episode, when there was that scene where Quentin, you know, like, basically told Oliver, like, the man that he's become and, like, how he's worthy of Laurel now or whatever, you know? Like, that's a moment that works so well when you're considering how he started off with Laurel, the way that he used to treat Laurel, and then now in this imaginary world, how he would treat Laurel so much better. And that would have been his journey and his arc if the writers didn't hate Laurel, it would have, you know, that's how it would have turned out. But instead, Felicity wasn't anywhere involved in that, you know? And Felicity does not get to reap the benefits of the lessons that he should have learned from Laurel. So it's kind of weird. Because, like, yeah.
Maybe that's not, why he keeps, like, repeating the same mistakes.
Right. Right. Like, the only thing that has changed is that he's monogamous now. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
He doesn't cheat. Which is great. Like, yay, he doesn't cheat. But that's, like, bare minimum, right? Like, yeah, you shouldn't cheat. Thank you. So anyway.
And what's interesting, too, is they paired her with Ray in that episode. Not even, like, in a dream world, yeah. where he and Felicity are together.
Right. And it didn't snap him out of the dream. Just right. Like, you know, whereas if it had been Barry and Iris, it would have immediately snapped Barry out. But, you know, anyway. William, I think, has actually helped give them a direction with the ship. It made parenthood their main drive. But it also has the same effect that Nora does on West Allen, which weakens the romantic bond, even as it strengthens the family bond. Now, the issue with, you know, having a stronger family bond with Oliver and Felicity is that they don't have the foundation outside of the romance in a story. Like, because they had an OTA, but mm-hmm. now they've separated things out, like Diggle's out with Argus and Felicity's, you know, I don't know, hacking, and Oliver's has been in jail, or now he's, you know, dealing with a new vigilante, etc. So they're not in all, like, one unified front, which makes it hard to know where they're going to, or for them to know where they're going to put the romance down, like what foundation they're going to lay the romance on top of. Plus, they've made that really odd narrative choice of removing William from the present, making them, like, quote unquote, abandon William, which makes them look like bad parents when parenting is their main goal right now, their main drive. They even talk about William when William's not there. Like, they'll be like, we're doing this for William, but where is William? Anyway, so then you have him in the future, though, in the future where they seem to be dead or not around, and all he's got are, like, bitter or tainted memories of them, which is really weird because, again, it makes it look like their union was not a success. So, I don't know. We're going to see if later down the line he has that same come-to-Jesus moment that Nora had, where he realizes that his parents love each other so much, and they're, like, the OTP of all OTPs. Maybe that will happen. And Felicity, you know, is the coolest. We don't know. We'll see. But it hasn't happened yet, and there's not a sense that it is going to happen. So we will see. Anyway, I think the crossover is meant to be a turning point, so we're going to see if 2019 has them acting like true partners, has Oliver actually being ride or die for Felicity, and being like, yes, all Felicities are the right Felicity. So we'll see. Hopefully.
Oliver and Felicity are interesting because I still think the writers aren't fully invested in them, like you said, and just interested in moving forward with them at all. So it's like why they always give them internal conflict every crossover, only for them to, like, circle back around to trust issues over and over again. And it's one thing for it to happen once, and it's another thing when Oliver reverts back to old habits because of his inability to treat Felicity as an equal partner in their relationship. And I think the writers always write them a bit better after they've experienced some time apart. Like in season 5, Oliver was dating Susan and Felicity was dating someone else until he died. And then she was doing her own thing until they reunited at the end of the season. And then the same thing happened in season 7. And I think their reunions are fine and the writers do okay with the buildup right before they get back together. But they don't have, like, a solid foundation to build off of, so they never grow after they've resolved any of their latest issues. So I think part of the struggle, notably this season, is that they seem to enjoy Oliver the way he was, which was full of darkness, being a loner, making fun of his, like, womanizer ways back in the day. So, like, the whole prison storyline and callbacks and regression in Elseworlds was an example of that. And that's frustrating for the anchorship, because while the writers have managed to keep Felicity afloat, their lack of growth won't help them to leave the dock either. So meanwhile, Felicity only gets to shine when Oliver isn't really around, and then she was disrespected a lot recently in the relationship, even to the point that her husband still didn't trust and respect her enough to tell her the truth, and then their makeup didn't quite acknowledge the doubts she was feeling. So I think that's an overall problem moving into 7B. And I know they have a large fandom for sure, and I don't think the writers are interested in breaking them up for good now that they've come this far, but I also don't feel like their character arcs help them grow and learn to become stronger as a couple, as a unit. And I think Oliver sometimes comes off as someone who likes the idea of having a family, and Felicity fits into this idea, like the way he's constantly concerned that William will be left alone, but he's sure Felicity will be with him if he can't. But if Oliver grows up and progresses, and learn to respect and trust Felicity without constantly having to be called out for not doing just that, then maybe they will finally be able to prosper, or he'll die next crossover and that won't be an issue anymore. moving on to our Arrow beta ship. I don't even know. Dyla? Mm-mm. Who knows?
I will say, like, before we get into the beta ship, I feel like the, because I know we talked about a lot about, you know, it was like the roast, Oliver roast during the crossover, but I think a lot of that is mainly Guggenheim. And I think he was trying to, like, for him, poke fun, like, oh yeah, we think Oliver's an asshole too, and, you know, Oliver's trash, blah, 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 blah. But, like, you're the one that made him that way. You wrote him as a trash, as a garbage person. So it kind of feels, it does make me feel like a little bit offended for Oliver that Mark Guggenheim like wrote these episodes and wrote so much, you know, all these other characters like harping on him and like, you know, pointing out his promiscuous ways, because that's like, that's the trash monster that you created. So you don't really get to like laugh with us at that. <so. laughs> And then I think they also, probably part of the reason why that they pit Felicity against Wes Allen, especially in the crossovers, and always make Felicity seem beneath Wes Allen, is because they know that it pisses their fandom off, and they also thrive off of that discord and conflict, because that generates like social media buzz or whatever, which is like really shitty. But anyways, beta ships. You can argue that is Dyla, but I call you a liar, because for Dyla to be a beta ship, the writers would have to actually care about Lila and write her into a story, let alone have that story parallel to Felicity. And, you know, like as I mentioned earlier, I think Arrow primarily stays afloat by splitting Oliver's heart and romance between Oliver William and Felicity. And then secondary to that, I think, and this is another kind of, like, Cisco and Caitlin were kind of the non-canon ship, beta ship for The Flash. I think this season in Arrow is Renee and Dinah. I think they're a stronger beta ship compared to Dyla. And the show seems to be leaning, like, a lot into Renee and Dinah this season and paralleling it directly to Oliver and Felicity, both in the present and in the future. So Oliver and Felicity share Kit and William. Renee and Dinah, like, basically share Zoe. like, she's Aunt Dinah, and in the future, Dinah is Zoe's, like, closest, like, adult relative or person in her life. And, like, in the future, like, Felicity is presumed bad and missing and dead. Renee is presumed not around, like, not on the same side as the good guys. So there's parallels there. And he's also, like, out of the immediate picture. And then even though, like, Curtis, it's kind of interesting because, like, Curtis was also, like, a really integral part of NTA. And in season 6, it seemed really even between the three of them. But now in season 7, he's, like, been largely cut off from Renee and Dinah. And Renee and Dinah seem a lot closer with Curtis on his own at Argus. Just like Diggle, who has been cut out of OTA and is now only at Argus. So, like, they're the kind of, like, the forgotten children.
No.
And it's, like, Felicity and Renee and Dinah are running, like, the parallels for this season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a weird parallel. They both cut out their third party. But yeah, I agree, though. I like the idea of Renee and Dinah as a submarine ship in much the same way I feel that Caitlin and Cisco feel like a submarine ship of The Flash. And I think it's the easiest way to tell that Diggle and Lila are not the submarine ship is the fact that Juliana and Rick were promoted to series regulars after just one season of being in recurring roles. Like, as soon as possible, they're like, oh, hey, guess what? You're regulars now. And then on the same token, Audrey Marie Anderson can't even get a promotion despite being around since season 1. So she's been a guest star for 7 seasons now, and they have never, ever felt the need to make her more than that. As we know, the submarine ship used to be Thea and Roy, and I think that the way that they have him just dodging discussions of her in the future and being, like, randomly angry about Star City is going to mean that they're going to, like, bring back that ship in some way. Like, obviously they won't have Willa Holland, but they're going to do some kind of, like, underwater work in 2019. Like, this is what happened to us. And then, like, maybe at the end they'll be like, oh, I guess I'm going to go find Thea again or whatever. And then we'll have, like, a minimum amount of submarine ship work from them. But yes, for the most part, it is Renee and Dinah. And we may even see some kind of parallel in terms of their separation, right? Because we know that they're on opposite sides of the city in the future. And they're going to come face to face, perhaps, in upcoming episodes. Maybe that will parallel Oliver and Felicity if they are both alive in the future in some way. Or it'll parallel them in the present.
I think it'll be like the child. So it'd be like Zoe and Renee, and then William when he comes in contact with Felicity.
With Felicity. There you go. The parent and child dynamics. Parent and step-child dynamics, if you will. Yes. I like it.
Yeah, the beta ship is definitely Renee and Dinah. And I think they've grown a lot closer this season in particular. And while they have like their disagreements, they truly and deeply care for each other. Diggle and Lila have had several chances to be the beta ship, but they never really got there. And I think part of the reason is because they like having Diggle be Felicity's number one fan. And if they have him become more invested in his own relationship, then Oliver and Felicity will no longer have anyone cheerleading, you know, for them. And they also don't care about Diggle. Like, let's be honest, they don't. Thea and Roy were a stronger beta ship, I agree, when they hadn't pulled the trigger on Felicity yet. And that could be because Laurel was written to be like Thea's big sister and sounding board, while she was still more important to the narrative and as a character and love interest. So they more strongly had those parallels. But then after like Felicity was introduced, I feel like all the beta ships kind of just floated.
Floated away out to sea. Debris on the ocean of Felicity.
More exciting than beta ships on this show is the crack ship corner that Jess is very excited about for this section.
I don't even know what to call them. I just call them like the Blackbirds. So Dinah and cute. Laurel. Because it's like enemies to lovers, OTP for the win. It's like textbook. Juliana and Katie have just like crazy chemistry together. And I feel like Dinah on the Arrow is my Iris because I can crack ship her with like a lot of people. And I feel like it's because Juliana has crazy chemistry with people that she's not actually supposed to have crazy chemistry with. Like, it's not supposed to be like a ship thing, but it just turns into one. So I remember like last season, everyone was like really confused with all this like sexual tension between like Dinah and Diggle. So there's like Draggle, and then there's like Laurel this season, and then a little bit with Renee also this season. But by and far, Dinah Laurel is my crack ship. I know it's supposed to feel for Dinah because Laurel killed her boyfriend and all, but like when she's like all up in Laurel's face and like ranting about how much she wants to kill her and, you know, can't because of reasons and all this thing is just like, kiss! Now kiss! Because it's so good. There's so much like tension there. And then, like, even coming from that, like, I love the growth in their dynamic this season, both, like, individually. So they're both going through things. They're both, like, Laurel specifically is becoming, like, she's learning how to adult and be, like, a decent person and, you know, share her toys and all that kind of stuff. So I like seeing that growth for her. And then Dinah slowly, like, defrosting and, like, coming around to being, you know, she used to be, you know, I want her to die, and now she's a little bit of a champion for Laurel's growth. Like, she sees that, and she's, like, rooting for her, and she's, like, you know, there, when Laurel's about to, like, go over the edge and backslide, like, Dinah's right there, like, you can do this. And so, like, yes! LTP! Now kiss! I love, like, the episode where we had, like, that Laricity, like, the OT3 team up with Dinah, Laurel, and Felicity. And that Felicity was kind of that bridge, because, you know, she's really close to Dinah, and then she got really close with Laurel, and then she was the bridge that brought these two ladies together, and, you know, introduced the concept of pizza dates, so now hopefully, like, Laurel and Dinah can go out on a pizza date or something like that. I don't know, I'm just, like, throwing ideas out there.
For free. Pick them up.
For free.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. Like, Dinah is my crack shipping powerhouse. There's no one that I couldn't see myself shipping her with. And I totally agree that Dinah and Laurel are the perfect recipe for a slap, slap, kiss scenario. And one that would serve as an excellent parallel to the anchor ship in terms of, like, trusting people after having large reasons to distrust them or loving every side of someone or whatever. Just even, like, being partners and lifting each other up while working together, but having different methods. I don't know. I think it worked really great. But, unfortunately, it's not happening.
Right now. So far. It's not happening right now.
Last thing to go. So, it could still happen. It could still happen. Also, like you said, like, Dinah has chemistry with everyone. So, Dinah and Diggle would have been awesome if Lila didn't exist. And Lord knows the show does not remember that she exists half the time. So I'm just saying that could have been fine. And then Diane Renee obviously is my fan and ship with the best chance of becoming a beautiful reality based on this season and how it is shaping up. But if it does not, then I am all aboard Dinah and Laurel. And,
ooh. I want to throw in a crack ship that I forgot about until this moment that you said this season. Emiko and Renee.
Oh.
Oh.
That's a crack ship.
Yes. Okay. That's interesting.
Yes. Because he believes in the new Green Hood. He's the only one that she trusts.
The new Green Hood. Yeah.
Maybe she's the reason he stayed in the Glades.
He's like the mayor of the Glades. Like,
Oh my God, it's a love triangle.
It is.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's intense. That's intense.
May. I mean, yeah, Diane and Laurel have a strong love-hate relationship. I love it. Like, they can bring out the worst in each other, but also the best when need be, and they do have lots of chemistry. And I agree, it's a shame that they killed Draggle. Like, it didn't even have to be a romantic ship, but they stopped letting them have scenes together, too. It's like, as soon as they noticed that something was happening, they're like, oh, shit, we gotta shut this down.
Turn it off, Juliana, turn it off.
Like, people were writing articles about it. I thought it was hilarious. and I hope Dilora City isn't dead. I have high hopes for much more Dinah and Renee in 7B as well. And now that the Emiko is now on the table, because I forgot.
Right?
That is very exciting. So final thoughts on Arrow, naughty or nice for 2018?
Naughty. Yeah, they're naughty. Like, when they're not trying to have, like, Oliver wrap Felicity in, like, bubble wrap and view her through these, like, rose-colored glasses. They're trying to trick us into believing, like, Felicity's to come to the darkness in the future and she's, like, questionable in the present. And none of it seems to be progressing, like, either character or the ship at all. So it's just kind of, you know, I don't know what they're doing. And I don't like that.
Yeah, I'm also on the naughty ship, or the naughty side for their ships. They have an anchor ship. So they're already a step up from Supergirl, which is good job. But they don't use it to its fullest potential, which is a shame because we know that Oliver and Felicity have plenty of chemistry and they have a huge fan base. So there's no reason why they couldn't make it happen. And there's no sign of a genuine submarine ship yet. So, yeah, more coal. More coal for you.
Lots of coals being passed out right now. yeah, definitely naughty. They glossed over Felicity's very real issues of not feeling like an equal partner in their relationship that started plaguing them since the end of season 6. By having Oliver give a nice speech, it felt more like they were putting a band-aid on a gaping wound. So, sucks for you, Arrow. Sorry. 2019, hope you do better. Moving on to our wild child, Legends of Tomorrow. Definitely has an anchor ship this season. That's very exciting. So, Ava Lance. Woohoo! What are our thoughts on the newest anchor ship of Legends of Tomorrow and how they fared?
That is my thought. My thought is woohoo. I am loving Ava Lance this season. I think Phil Clemmer has really grasped how to do an anchor ship for the show, finally. And it's different on a show like Legends that's always moving. And it's one where physically separating the ship by having Ava stay at the Bureau while Sarah leads the Wave Rider is actually a good idea. It actually helped Ava feel like a grounding force for Sarah. It helps Sarah feel like an escape for Ava. And it allows the sort of, you know, episode-by-episode case adventures be their own little universe that people can enjoy while still having this, like, tiny connecting thread of romances, of interpersonal relationships. So it's a really nice balance that I was not expecting Legends to find. And it allows them to have big moments in the episodes like the camp episode without bogging down the wacky action-adventure story. I think that the show might see relationship drama as extra baggage again because it was a ship that was not conceived as part of Legends' original DNA. In fact, Sarah was kind of like a very flighty character in terms of her romances. So now they've had to not rework her, but she had to grow a lot in order to accept this ship, which is good because that gives it like a sense of dynamism, right? It's character growth for her. It makes Ava a valuable part of the story. And I think that it's been incorporated really well. So I'm really happy. I hope that they're able to keep it going, right? Because so far, Legends has not yet succeeded in keeping an anchor ship for more than a season. But its time may have come.
Yeah, I really agree with you on both points. One, that it feels like a grounding force throughout the show, because like Legends is such a wild ride that, like, you know, like last season, we felt like there's just like spinning donuts in the parking lot. And so it's like, you know, you're not going anywhere, but you're having fun. And with, like, introducing that grounding force of Avon Sarah, it feels a little bit more connected, and that you have all of these like adventures, but there's also that like thread of like coming home, or like home between the two of them. And then also like what you mentioned about there being growth for Sarah, because I feel like if this was like last season, then, you know, I would not expect this Sarah in the relationship that she has with Ava now. Like, it just wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't feel like Sarah to me. And because I don't think it was earned last season, and this season it does feel earned. It's actually come like a really long way since last season, become like a really healthy and stable ship for Legends. And, you know, again, I'm going to take the easy way out and credit this sudden shift in writing of them to Guggenheim, like, no longer being a showrunner, and no longer having any kind of like immediate influence in how they're writing Sarah as a character, because I really do think he considered her female Oliver, and, you know, he already self inserts into Oliver, male Oliver, and I think he did the same with Sarah, especially with regards to her love life, which is why she like suffered, I think, in the first 2.5-3 seasons of the show, with all these like sporadic like one night stands, and they're always exclusively like women, and so that like her bisexuality part of her suffered, I think, as well. And I think this is just all because Guggenheim is just like gross. And I feel like we mentioned in season 3 like how Sarah as a character felt adrift, as because she's technically like the default lead. Her and Ray are like default leads of the show, the highest billed like actors within the ensemble. But it didn't really feel like Sarah had any kind of like grounding place within like being the captain of the ship, or that she had any kind of stories or narratives that pushed the story forward. And it was clear from Ava's first appearance in season 3 that they were at least going to have paid sex at one point. And none of us like Ava initially. Because the build between them really felt a little bit uneven at times. But what I disliked the most season 3 is how their first kiss felt forced, because it came in the middle of this like fabricated argument over, I don't even remember what it was about, but they're just arguing over nothing. It was just building up. And it's just kind of really obvious that this is our argument was like had to happen to get them to kiss. And the moment that they did kiss was only written in so that they could be objectified by Blackbeard the pirate to come in and be like, ooh, two ladies kissing, you know, like, and I didn't like that at all. Then you skip to late season 3 and then season 4 after Guggenheim announces that he's stepping down after the whole AJK and the Me Too thing. The ship seems to have not only steadied, because you had like the Vancouver episode, which was really good for Ava's character development and backstory. So it kind of like steadied out into late season 3, and then season 4 it blossomed into this like healthy, functioning, normalized woman-woman relationship that you don't really see a lot of outside of like Grey's Anatomy on ABC, probably. But with Sarah being like the default lead of her show, and having this ship be the prominent ship of the show, and having it be so like healthy and normalized and stable, I think has really been like a great asset to the show this season. Great benefit. I feel like Sarah is finally being like centered in the story and with her anchorship, and it has a passionate fan base. The writers clearly seem to be like invested in this relationship more than they used to be in season 3. And so I agree with you that I hope it continues to like grow and be like an anchoring force for the show, because I really like what they're doing with it so far. And I hope they don't like derail it for like nonsense. So, but they appear to be past that. So hopefully that stays.
Like, they didn't start off on the right foot with the ship, but once they stopped trying to make Sarah want to run away at every chance, Avalan started to become more a fully realized ship. And they've definitely paved the way to showing what a healthy long-distance style of relationship could look like, which is really nice. And Sarah hasn't had, like, a place to call home or even, like, a year to call home. And Ava provides that base for her, and Ava gets to become a fully realized person outside of Sarah while she's away doing her thing, because we get to see what she's up to at the Time Bureau. And occasionally they get to go on adventures together. So they've reached a nice balance, like you guys said, and finally seem steady enough to the point that the relationship is really letting them grow as people, individually and together. So getting rid of the excess drama from last season allowed them to flourish. And it seems like the writers are finally invested in building this relationship and giving them nice, you know, nice magical moments together like they did at the summer camp with their kiss. Moving into the beta ship, we'll start with Dark Adam, because I have a different beta ship.
I think that's there might be like a strong side ship, but I think Dark Adam is like the proposed beta ship that the narrative is probably going with. But there is a strong side ship. Yes. I'll call them side ships.
Side ships.
Strong ships that are not beta ships.
I do think that Dark Adam is a submarine ship or the proposed submarine ship. And it parallels Avalanche thematically as well as literally. So, like, Nora sees herself as a dark figure who is unworthy of love. Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. Much like Sarah used to see herself as that, right? That was why she pushed Ava away. And Ray draws her out like Ava did Sarah. Ray's been searching for his purpose, right? Like, what's his meaning? What's his role to play? Similar to, like, Ava sort of feels unmoored because now she's found out she's a clone, right? She's like, oh, what do I mean? What is my purpose? Why am I here? So, like, in the episode where Ray finds out or learns that he's, like, the beta team or whatever, he then, like, uses that opportunity instead of, like, feeling sad like he would have in previous seasons. Like, oh, I'm useless. All I have is my Adam suit, as he's done in the past. He's like, oh, I'm going to go find Nora. I'm going to go write her a little letter. I'm going to go do this for her, right? So he's found a purpose in helping Nora, in drawing her out, in loving her, whatever. While Ava sort of sees Sarah as kind of her safe harbor, right? Every time that she feels lost or unmoored or like she doesn't mean anything, Sarah's the one that kind of helps her, you know, gives her a purpose and like reminds her that she's like a real person and not a sex doll like Mick suggested.
Not like,
anyway,
but like he's
yes, like he suggested. Furthermore, they are also physically separated by the Bureau Wave Rider dichotomy. So both of them are on two opposite locations and sort of linking those two locations together with their love. Okay, that being said, for this season specifically, I also think that Constantine and Desmond are providing another nice parallel with Avalanche. And like Jessica said, they're more of like a side chick, which again, you can tell because Desmond is not a regular cast member. He is a guest star. But we get the concept of loving someone through darkness and through light. And how that's important, right? The lengths that you will go to save someone from the darkness. And also we get the visual parallel of the kiss, right? The kiss is powerful enough to change time. It's Ava and Sarah changing back to themselves while they are kissing in the camp episode. So I would say that Legends putting such relatively little focus on the romances has this season coincidentally allowed more of them to blossom without weighting the story down, right? I don't think that we've ever had three romances on Legends that were good. So, this is revolutionary.
Yeah, and I don't know if, like, I do think, I agree with you that Constantine and Desmond is a strong, like, side ship, but as far as the narrative of the series as a whole, the show as a whole, I think Dark Adam is the submarine ship to Avalanche's anchor ship. And, like, I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but they built the ships at the same time. So Dark Adam blossomed, the concept of Dark Adam blossomed in season three, like Avalanche was building up in season three. So they've been like growing almost like in parallel for two seasons. So like Avalanche is a clear anchor and the one that the writers are obviously the most invested in as their prominent ship. However, Dark Adam has, like, this slow build where it's, well, it's, like, a little bit more muted than Avalanche is, and even than Constantine and Desmond, since that's, like, a plot point. more than like a steady build of a ship, Dark Adam is still kind of like progressing steadily. So it is kind of like a submarine in that, you know, it's like muted, like you don't, you kind of don't know that it's there, but it's still like progressing steadily and like underneath the surface, really. Narratively, it's like a timey-wimey romance, so it's like a little bit complicated. And I know that like some of our Anons have had issues with, since that like Rey first really interacted and got to Nora when she was a teenager. And that's like, I don't know, it's just kind of weird. And even like chronologically, when she was a preteen, Rey was dating Felicity on Arrow. So, you know, his, and his reasoning for wanting to save Nora as an adult stemmed from the time that he spent trying to save her as a teen. So I, like, I get why people can't like separate that clearly. And I guess I will say that I don't think he set out to fall in love with her as an adult. And so, like, the whole thing with time travel relationships in literature and TV shows as a concept is weird because time traveler may see or experience, like, many time periods of the love interest life and has a sort of kind of, like, immortality that the love interest does not. And so it's kind of like vampire. So Rey is like a vampire in the situation. So it's like a Twilight thing where Edward is like 300 something years old and Bella is only like 16. But, you know, they're vampires, so whatever.
He didn't have like a lasting effect on her. You know, he didn't like shape her as a person. He wasn't any kind of like authoritative figure in her life.
And she didn't remember him really as an adult.
And him, it was like one day to the next. Like he met this child. And now she's an adult. Like, it wasn't like he experienced her growing up and then feelings shifted from, you know, whatever, big brotherly, fatherly to romance or whatever. So I don't think that you can really make, like, a pedophile parallel. Wait. That some people might want to.
Yeah. It's just, like, you know, when you get into, like, time travel as, like, a genre, romance genre, or even, like, vampires or things where, like, one half of the OTP is, like, immortal and the other half is not, then, you know, it, you get all this, like, weird stuff. But all of that aside, I do think, like, the strength of the ship can be seen through the change in Nora. So, like, her development from being an evil person to, you know, her redemption is all because of Rey's light. And then the only, like, minor complaint that I had about the ship this season was the, like, nice guy TM narrative that they were starting to build at the start of the season, because all the characters were like, Nora would be crazy not to fall in love with you. You're such a nice guy, Rey. And, you know, Nora wasn't even in those episodes, so it was kind of feeling like very, like, lopsided with how they're like, if she doesn't approve of you, then she's a bitch or there's something wrong with her, you know, that kind of thing. But thankfully, that was corrected once she was reintroduced, and it didn't affect, like, Rey, as in he didn't treat her as if she owed him affection. So I like that they did not do that, because I was a little bit concerned. But I do agree with you, especially with like the parallels of Dark Adam to Avalanche with the dark and the light, and also that Desmond and Constantine are a really strong side ship for this season because of the plot and how they are kind of integral to it, and the whole turn of the season is around, you know, Constantine and Desmond's love and him trying to save Desmond from the hell that he sent him to in the first place. So that's, yeah, it's a strong side ship, I think.
I was actually going to start off with them, but I will add to the, because you were mentioning vampires when it came to Nora and Rey, and I don't know why I distinctly thought of, like, the time traveler's wife, in which, like, he was an adult when he first met her, and so was she, but she first met him as a child with, like, his much older self. So it's just, like, all convoluted and crazy and all that stuff. But for the strong side ship, before I get into Dark Adam, Desmond and Constantine, and I think because they became so prominent in such a short amount of time, but they definitely screamed beta ship to me initially. Like, they nicely parallel Ava Land, so that Constantine is like Sarah and Desmond is like Ava, and the relationship is also driving the overall plot moving into 4B, and they managed to rewrite time with a kiss and the power of love. So they had like major moments in the span of two episodes. So it was like super strong coming in. And yes, of course, Dark Adam is another, is the beta ship that parallels Avalanche, primarily. And like you said, it started off with them in season three and then moving into season four. And then Nora wanting to change because of Rey, but also making that choice to do so for herself was nice. And it built them up in the final few episodes of season 4A without forcing Nora into just into it just because Rey liked her, like Jess said. Like, she got to have her own perspective eventually and reasons for why she was doing what she was doing. But her development was helped along by Rey, which is what a ship should do, but not, like, dictate what she should be doing. And, like, for the first time in Legends history, like Tati mentioned, the writers have finally managed to balance romance without hindering anything else. So they have three relationships at the same time, which is something they've never had before. So when I think back on, like, Legends season one, I can't even imagine that this is where they've come, because that was a shit show when it came to romance. But Legends has a lot of space to have crack ships. So what are your crack ships for this show?
It's a crack ship paradise.
It really is.
That is very, very true. There are so many options. But for me, I'm going to just, you know, follow the lead of Jessica, who will come later, but she is the, you know, the warrior for this ship. Exactly. Time travel. Is Zari and Charlie. I love that we got that kernel of hope when she, you know, brought up that Amaya was hot. And I think that it's one of the few potential craft ships, of which there are many, that wouldn't mess with any of the pairings that we currently have, because we have so many pairings already. But I really love, like, their at this rate, I think it's been, like, the way we were talking about with the Blackbirds, with Dinah and Laurel, like, that like, coming together from, like, opposite sides, so, like, their opposite personalities and also, like, viewpoints. And they've been, like, clashing a lot early on the season. But now, like, they're starting to be on even footing, like, sort of, like, see the other perspective. So I like that kind of, like, enemies to friends to lovers dynamic that I enjoy. Also, I did ship Zari and Amaya last season, which is why at first I was like, oh, I don't know if I liked it because she's still in Amaya's body, but it's just not Amaya. It's kind of weird. But I think that they've done a really good job of disassociating Charlie from Amaya. And also, Zari didn't like Charlie at first because she had taken Amaya's body. So I think that adds a good level to this imaginary
separation.
yeah well, of separation, but also, like, it adds meaning or depth to the ship itself by acknowledging the elephant in the room. So
so Zarly, Zarly all the way. We are Zarly crack shippers over here. Like, Tala, Ash, and Maisie Sellers had, like, chemistry even as Zari and Amaya, so it's no, like, coincidence that the chemistry is still in effect even with Maisie playing a different character. And I didn't have problems separating Amaya from Charlie, even though, ironically, Charlie only looks like Amaya because you co-opted her face. But I think that, you know, Charlie's personality, who she is, her core drive as a character, is different enough from Amaya that I don't see them as the same person. So, like, they could write an episode where Amaya, like, comes back and, like, Maisie's doing double duty as Charlie and Amaya, and I would just think that they're just two separate people. So I like that. And even, I think because of that, because Charlie is such a separate person, that I can see her and Zari as a completely different ship. And I think because you can see that they're two separate people, that I can see Zari and Charlie as a completely separate ship, as, like, Amari, which is, like, Amaya and Zari. So I can ship both. I can crash ship both and be okay. I haven't really been a big fan initially of Zari's, like, attitudes towards Charlie, just because I have an issue with how the Legends in general have treated Charlie. But I think the winter finale has done a lot to signal kind of a turning of the page between Zari and Charlie and their relationship. And I hope that they continue to get closer and explore that. So I think there's a lot of potential there for, you know, at least them becoming, like, really good friends and kind of, like, the two kind of rule breaker kids that I think they should have gotten, they should have had that kind of relationship in the beginning, which is because I think they're just so similar, and the fact that they do like to be rebels and rule breakers. So hopefully now that they've gotten past that, we can start to see that more. And then I would say minorly steal Adam, mainly because of Ray and how much he like values his bromance with Nate. And, aww, you know, like, for example, like how sad he was when Nate didn't come back to the ship. Even like when Nate brought Piggy Ray to meet like his dad, and then like he turned to human Ray like in his arms and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was just like the cutest thing. And then like how happy he was a couple episodes later that he's going to get to see him again, because he knew like seeing Nate like getting a hug, like that was like the reason why he was so excited, getting a hug from Nate and then also like advice. So it's just like great. It's basically great because he's just so pure and he loves Nate so much that I like seeing them together.
Aww. I fully agree with Zarly. Obviously, like they started off on the wrong foot because of Zari's stubbornness and not wanting to see Charlie for who she is, but then that changed. So I love that the dynamic is actually developing. So they have a strong foundation for becoming canon if the writers wanted to go that route. Yeah, that's my only crack ship for the show, which we said they had a lot of options, but we only kept it to like,
there are only a few that we like.
Yeah, just because there's a lot of actresses, I mean, they're all good at them.
That's true.
Remember when we used to think that Nick and Amaya would be a great ship?
Yeah. Oh my god.
Wow. Yeah. Times they are a changing.
Never again. So what are our final thoughts on Legends? Naughty or nice?
Nice. Legends doesn't give their ships a whole lot, but what they do is steady and solid. And this season, very romantic. Our answer would have been extremely different last year, this time last year. But season 4 is living its best life, and I am so proud of it.
It is living its best life. This is also a nice. I thought we only had one, because I thought it was going to be the Flash alone, the Golden Child standing by itself. But no, we do have a Silver Place medalist, and that is Legends of Tomorrow. I think Avalanche has reached a really happy, healthy normality, and then Dark Adam is slowly burning into like a strongly solid foundation. And I like that it just seems like this season the writing team was like, okay, we're gonna establish our anchor in our beta, and we're gonna like be solid, and you know, it feels like it's really coming together for them this season, and I like it.
Definitely nice. I think they currently have a strong anchor ship, like you guys said. And then, like, the nice beta ship and the strong side ship coming up beside the anchor. So they're ready to set sail and go anywhere that the writers want to take them. So that's really, really nice. Moving on to our not-so-new kid on the block anymore, Black Lightning, whose anchor ship is disappointingly now Kennifer or Jaheel or whatever their ship name is.
Aww.
So how do we feel about that shift in the narrative?
Not good. Is that like, you know, it's the anchor ship, you know, whether you like it or not, that is the ship that is moving the entire show and the one that the writers are the most invested in. And I feel like I'm not enjoying Black Lightning as much this season as I did in season 1. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with the writers' shift towards promoting Jennifer and Khalil as their anchor ship over Jefferlyn, and then more importantly over Thundergrace. Because, like, breaking this down into, like, three components, the foundation, the fan support, and the writer investment, Kennifer has the writer's investment in spades. Like, clearly that is the thing that they care about the most, that they find the most interesting, that they want to write about. I don't know why, because it's the most, like, toxic relationship on the show, but the writers, I don't know if it's, like, love China and Jordan's chemistry, or, you know, if Selene McKeel's real life accusations also bleeds into the show. I don't know, but writer support, they have a lot of that. Season 1, they seem like minorly interested in the relationship, but not invested yet in Jennifer, in the relationship or Jennifer overall, because it was the Anissa season. But the writers seem to be most invested in Jennifer when her story is tied to Khalil. So even in season one, the story that she did have was the story of her blossoming teen romance with Khalil when it was cute. And, you know, once Khalil got shot, and when that all went downhill, so did Jennifer's screen time, I feel like. And that also leads into the foundation. Like, the ship is built with, like, burnt and rotting wood, basically. Like, it's not a good ship at all. It used to be. Like, it started out really innocent and cute and very promising. But then when he gets paralyzed, how he treats Jennifer and, you know, who's been there for him since day one ruins much of the ship for me. I mean, there's, like, I can understand, like, there's anger at the world and lashing out because of something traumatic happened to him. But that's one thing. But then the other thing is, like, how he blamed Jennifer when he didn't even know, you know, I guess you can say because she invited him there. But, like, he blamed her. He pushed her away. He made all of that her fault. He pushed her away. He sought to, like, even, like, not just pushing her away, because that's just, like, some kind of, like, Batman, I have to be alone kind of
thing. Right, noble idiocy.
Yeah. But on top of that, he sought to humiliate her, like, amongst her friends at school. And when she didn't even do anything to deserve that. She did nothing to try to be there for him, and he went out of his way to humiliate her, and I think that crossed the line. And all of that toxic, like, hate gets exacerbated when he teams up with Tobias and becomes Painkiller. And then, like, as much as the writers tried to retcon Khalil back to, like, pre-paralysis personality in the first half of this season, as soon as Jennifer saved him, he started talking again like she was his girlfriend. Like, he was like, as soon as she saved him from, like, the Hunger Games, he was like, so, let me know about your powers. Like, I gotta know if I feel like a girl looks at me a certain way, if you're going to get kind of crazy, I need to know what I'm dealing with. I'm like, why do you even know what you're dealing with? Because you're not together. Like, why is that even a topic of discussion? She's not your girl, but apparently she was, I guess, because they ran off together. And it just, like, the whole thing just turned me off. Everything about their Bonnie and Clyde episode is just, like, full of red flags for me. His temper gets, like, so bad to the point that he gets almost violent. Like, he almost hits, like, he puts up his arm to almost, like, backhand her in the car. All because she wanted to call her parents. And that's not okay. And the narrative is written as if this is, like, love story. Like, the next episode where they continue their, you know, escape route and, she doesn't even go home to her family that are clearly there because they care about her and they miss her, and she hides from them. And it's written as this, like, me and you against the world. Like, what world? The only world that you're against is Tobias. Like, why are you running from your family when they're the ones that could help you with your actual problem, which is Tobias? And I just, like, the whole idea that the writers are writing this narrative that parents and concerned sisters and neighbors and aunties just don't understand because we're in love or whatever. It's toxic and it shouldn't be romanticized at all. And I feel like Jennifer is, like, a smart girl. She's really smart. She's book smart, very intelligent young lady. And the fact that they are, you know, there's a lot of young ladies watching this show, and this is what the writers are choosing to romanticize as a, like, the black woman that is ride or die from her ancient man is not, like, the romance that I would want young women to see on TV and to, like, look up to at all. So I'm not here for it at all.
So the anchor ship of season one of Black Lightning was Jefferlyn, but the writers were not invested in exploring it to the point that they even ignored the real reason of why they divorced in the first place. And it bothered me all of season one, and I've just forgotten about it for season two. But she told him to quit being Black Lightning, or else she would leave him. And he did quit, and she still was gone for a decade. And I don't understand why that happened, and they never made it make sense. So that is how invested they were in their anchorship in season one, which meant that their, you know, side ships, the submarine ship or whatever, whichever the submarine ship was going to be, didn't really have much room to float either. They didn't really have anything to really bounce off of. Grace totally disappeared from In This Is Life after, like, episode 5, and Khalil turned sour on Jennifer before she could, you know, do anything. Like, they had, like, two episodes of cuteness, and then it was like, I am a garbage person. So, the positive side, I guess, is that season two definitely found a direction to sail in. For whatever reason, they did become deeply invested in Jennifer and Khalil. They wanted it to flourish, and they have yet to look back from that direction. But, as Jessica pointed out, the foundation of the ship and the direction in which they are heading is toxic. And it hasn't done anything to help the other ships in question. It has not helped the others thrive. So, we've got Khalil, who came from being borderline abusive, or actually came from being abusive to now being borderline, I guess. But it's okay, because Jennifer, like, sasses him, I guess. And that's fine. But on the other hand,
narrator voice, it was not fine.
No, okay, right. It was not fine. But that's how they want you to perceive it. Like, oh, right. LOL, she threatened to chop off all his hair. Well, she did chop off all his hair, and then wouldn't let him chop off hers. Feminism! Okay, anyway. So, Grace and Anissa, is, like, that should be, I don't know, if not the anchor ship, the submarine ship, but their important moments are skipped over, glossed over, even in episodes where they, you know, like, if they even get to appear in the episode, they'll have, like, the resolution to the big fight just does not exist. And then the right. next episode you see them and they're just, like, you know, Netflix and chilling on the couch and you don't know how they got here. Similarly, Jefferson and Lynn are, like, together again, but there's no forward movement in their dynamic. Like, we only see them talk to each other about parenting and, like, oh, I did a science thing and it was really sad and I'm crying now. And I'm like, oh, poor Lynn. But, like, I don't know what they're actually doing with themselves as a relationship. Most of their scenes involve the family unit, which is fine. Like, you could say, oh, well, the family unit is the anchor, kind of like Supergirl. But that is not really 100% accurate, because
they're even, like, falling apart as a family.
Yeah, they're falling apart as a family because of Jefferson, because of Jennifer and Khalil. And the big romantic moments for Kennifer or Jaleel far outpace the family moments this season, and also outpace, you know, all the other ships. So Khalil was the reason that Jennifer was able to control her powers in the first place, right? When her parents were the ones kind of holding her back, or they were, like, they did not help to make her feel more comfortable about her powers. It was Khalil being in danger that made her feel more comfortable about her powers. Like, that is the thing that you give to your anchor ship.
And I feel like that's another one of my problems with it, that all of her powers are tied to Khalil.
Right.
In a ship that doesn't deserve it.
Right. It's only a problem. Like, this is a strong foundation for the ship. It's, you know, you compare it to a salad, but the problem is that the ship is shitty. Like, which it hurts me to say because I loved them so much before, but now it's like, no, thank you. I don't want this. It's like, yeah, anyway, it's fine. Not like this. Okay, so the likelihood of this ship lasting is a little bit slim, like, as an anchor, just because, to begin with, it's an unhealthy pairing, which isn't, you know, you could write an unhealthy pairing for as long as you want, but combined with the potential instability of the showrunner and their position on the show, it might lead to things switching things up pretty quickly in order to not make it look like things, you know, like the fiction is a reflection of the reality. We'll see. We'll see what they do there. So season three, if they're going to reorient, if they're going to give us a new anchor ship, obviously it should be Jefferson, precisely because it's supposed to be Jefferson's show, and it very, very nearly is not. Or if you want to hit the target demographic, because Thundergrace is the biggest, most popular ship on the show, right? Everyone wants Thundergrace, and it's still mostly viewed by younger audiences, then you can make Anissa and Grace the main ship, and there'd be so much story left to tell because everything's been left on the cutting room floor with them. Like, if you wanted to, like, have Grace's powers somehow be the reason that they blow up this season, like, maybe Grace pushes her away or whatever, and then next season Anissa, like, finds her, and then they work together to, you know, be little superhero partners or whatever they're gonna do to start the Outsiders, if you will. You could easily make them the anchor ship.
And they could use their, everything that was cut as flashbacks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Kennifer, Jaleel, I don't know. They really did feel like it was, it, it felt like it was over for them back in season one. And we were like, yes, finally, you know, it was not a good relationship and that ended. And that's when Jennifer Lynn was far more prominent too. So they got solo romantic scenes together, even though the reason for their separation made no sense, like Tati said. But clearly the show was invested in rekindling the romance so we can see it on screen, which is why it was weird that they practically dropped it completely moving into season two. So centering Jennifer and Khalil as the anchor ship in season two when the show is called Black Lightning was a mistake and changed the focus of the show after Khalil's redemption story began to take shape. And then the writers seemed to like writing for them, but the foundation, like you guys said, isn't as strong because it was built on a couple that had only just begun dating and somehow down the line it became ride or die material for each other, which is really ridiculous. So they're toxic. And the time spent focusing on them has actually pulled attention away from everyone else, which is not what an anchorship should be doing. They should be uplifting other relationships, but instead they're being told by everyone in the narrative this is not a good relationship, and then splitting apart, you know, all the relationships Jennifer already had with everybody else too. So they've taken away moments from Thunder Grace because it was the writer's because it has the writer's investment, and it's a problem because their relationship is romanticized when it shouldn't be, and it's steering the show in a completely wrong direction going into the second half of the season.
Yeah, and I was going to say one thing that you can tell that Jennifer is being written as the anchor ship is because all of the narrative plot points revolve around this angsty teen drama. Mm-hmm. So, like, in season one, Tobias's strongest connection to the story was through Jefferson. Jefferson and Tobias's, like, rivalry was what was driving the narrative, and so was Jefferlyn. But in season two, it's Khalil and Tobias. So Khalil and Tobias's, like, animosity towards each other, and Tobias, like, beating up Khalil and wanting to, like, punish Khalil and hurt Khalil is what's driving season two. And it's not even, you know, Tobias, Jefferson is hardly on Tobias's radar except through Khalil being connected to Jennifer, who is always being saved by Black Lightning. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, another reason that you know that it's Jennifer that's driving the show and not Jefferson or Jefferlyn or Thunder Grace.
Sad, sad times. We're moving into our beta ship. Who do we think is the beta ship at this point?
I don't think that they really have one right now, but I'm going to put Thunder Grace here just because the writers, like, they treat it as an afterthought, but they did make some progress this season, at least more so than Jefferlyn. Whether I'm satisfied with that progress is another thing, because I think, like, they don't care about Grace at all. It shouldn't be a beta ship, because they're not being paralleled to Jennifer, really. So there's nothing about that relationship that's being paired to Jennifer and Khalil, and it's not even being used to, like, support the main ship or anything like that. So it's really right now, it's just a side ship, because the writers don't really care about anything other than Jennifer and Khalil. Jefferlyn is also kind of a side ship this season because they have no scenes about their relationship or, you know, them moving forward other than them living under the same roof and not really talking about them still being divorced or separated or whatever it is. But I still want to talk about them, so I got to talk about them somewhere. So we're going to talk about them now. I think Thunder Grace has all the makings of a strong anchorship. It has, like, a huge fan base. It's the largest fan base on the show. And it has a strong comic canon foundation. The actresses love and promote the hell out of it. But the only thing that it doesn't have is the writer's investment. And particularly, I don't think they have, I don't know, like, I've talked about my frustrations with this ship before in some of, like, the episodes. But it doesn't seem like they are interested in anything about Anissa outside of her being Thunder. And so that kind of ties into how they kind of flip-flop on how they want to write her as a girlfriend or the romantic side of her, because it seems like, on one hand, she's all work and no play, and that's why she ghosted on Grace. But on the other hand, she's like, as soon as she is available, she's a player now. And so she goes for Zoe or whatever the singer's name is, and doesn't understand why Grace might have an issue with her not calling her back. And it's like, you know, pick a lane. Like, either one, like, it's she's work focused and that's the reason, or two, if she likes to play the field, then have that be the reason and not you know, not let's not try to like convolute it. I feel like they don't understand who Anissa is as a woman, like romantically. And they just don't care about Grace at all, to be honest. If they cared about Grace, I think we would have seen her more in season one outside of Anissa. For example, I think I feel like we had at one point theorized that maybe she was writing the Thunder fan blog because she was like really into comics, and they could have incorporated her more in that way so we could at least see her and see maybe why it was a problem for her that Anissa was ghosting her or not picking up her calls. And so it just really feels like in season two, when she's all upset that Anissa has moved on to Zoe, like, you know, either you're on her side and you see her side of things because they haven't focused on the relationship, or you're on Anissa's side. Like, why is Grace so clingy right now? Because we know we weren't even in that series. So why is she like making this seem like it's a big deal when it shouldn't be a big deal kind of thing? So I don't really think that they, and then they skip and jump through their relationship so that you see all of these moments that you're supposed to be like, okay, they're okay, but you don't even know how they got there. And so like they have this fight where Grace, you know, has like really good points about, I don't want to be used and just used for sex or whatever. And then the next scene you see Anissa talking to someone on the phone, but you don't know if it's Grace. And then all of a sudden they're Netflix and chilling, and you don't know how they got there from the conversation when Grace said, basically, we're breaking up, don't call me again kind of thing. Like, just leave me, just don't interact with me because I know how you are kind of thing. Right. So you don't really see any of the development in between there. So it's just kind of like they're throwing out these crumbs for people because they know that Thunder Grace is a thing, but they don't really care about it. So they're not invested in actually doing anything with it.
I agree that Black Lightning currently lacks a true submarine ship, but Thunder Grace is probably the one with the best chance of it. Even though I completely agree with Jessica that it's more like they just do it because they know that it is wanted and popular and not because they have a true investment in it. And I've kind of felt that way since before the show even premiered, because when I asked, that was like one of the first questions that I asked Nafisa about, because, you know, that was like, this is like a really important part of her character, and, you know, it's going to be one of the first times that we see something like this. And she didn't know about it. Like, she didn't know that it was going to happen, or she didn't know how much it was going to be a part of her character. So I was like, that's weird. And I know this because they only had like a 15-minute, you know, preview or whatever then, but I think at that point, the showrunners would have talked to them about their arc. So I never felt like it was something that really mattered to the showrunners. I think that you can easily parallel Anissa guiding Grace through her powers. Even if you keep Kennifer as the anchor ship, which you should not. And you can also parallel Jennifer needing to, like, her control of her powers sort of being helped by Khalil, with Anissa's wanderlust being cooled by Grace. And Khalil's rage, right? Khalil's rage is cooled, supposedly, by Jennifer. Gag. So, you know, you've got lots of parallels that are possible there. And Jessica's already provided many different storyline routes that they could take, especially if they want to go the way of the Outsiders, which they're already introducing the characters for. And one thing that I think is weird is just how slow the progress on the Grace side of Outsiders is. You know, like, we've seen that she has those powers, or that she's got something wrong with her, and then it's like two more episodes pass, and like, you don't even see her, right? You don't even know what's going on there.
Yeah, I feel like that won't kick off until it's like, boom, Outsiders, and then, like,
exactly.
Grace.
Right, yeah. And once again, to me, that suggests a lack of investment, because they have no problem just circling the drain with the same storyline. Several minutes of the same storyline in every episode, without it being, like, time to explode that story. So yeah, I hope that when we come back 2019, we've got much more investment in them, and more, what we need is a more conscious effort to write them and more consistency in how they are written. Like, they need a continuity editor or something to be like, this is the last thing that happened with Grace and Anissa, so let's pick up from there and show what happens next. But anyway, if Jefferlyn manages to regain its position of anchorship, then you can parallel Grace as the more cautious partner who is a homing beacon for Anissa, the way that Lynn is for Jefferson. Mm-hmm. So that would be really nice. Awesome. Two healthy and exciting ships that we could see next year.
I remember writing an article about like five reasons to be excited for Black Lightning, and one of them was Thunder Grace, and well, we know how that turned out.
You played yourself.
I did. Yeah, Thunder Grace absolutely should have been the beta ship. Like, they had a clear meet cute situation, and it's obvious that it was meant to help Anissa grow as a person as well, while eventually getting Grace to come into her own. But the writers really messed it up by, one, lacking any investment in the ship, and two, directors deciding that most of their scenes should be left on the cutting room floor, even when it makes no sense for them to do that at all. So the relationship is like pieces of a puzzle blown every which way, because their journey from one episode to the next has major gaps in it. So it has holes in the ship. And I think they were meant to parallel Jefferlyn, like you guys said, with Grace being the Lynn of the relationship and Anissa being the Jefferson of the relationship. But the writers seem to avoid writing them at all costs, and I don't understand why. And they really do have all the makings of a power couple if they just let them be. And we all know the fans are ready for them to get so much more screen time than they already given. Because we saw that they had like promo pictures for them, and they got a kiss, and they're sitting on the couch enjoying TV together, and then doesn't appear in the episode at all. So it makes no sense. But moving into our crack ship corner, do we have crack ships for Black Lightning?
I don't know, like Tobias and Death, maybe. This isn't like a crack shipping show. So it sucks that I still like Tobias in Death, because like I used to enjoy him like so much in mm-hmm. season one, but I feel like he's also suffered a lot in season two, and I don't know if that's like mostly because of the anchor ship being centered around Kennifer. I'm going to say that it is. It's because that the anchor ship is being centered around Kennifer, which means that Tobias's conflict is centered around his abuse towards Khalil, and mm-hmm. I just don't like that.
Yeah, I mean, right now his biggest issue is that Khalil has run away from him. He doesn't know Jefferson. So, it's it's just dumb. But yeah, for crack ships, the only one I can think of is maybe Jennifer and Keisha, if Keisha ever shows up again. Because, like, I think she showed up in one episode, the first episode of season two, and then she's like, okay, bye. I don't like metahumans. And then Jennifer's like, I'm so sad, my friend don't like metahumans. The end. Never again. But in general, I have to say that the show isn't getting its ships right, so, like, to begin with, so it's kind of hard to visualize crack ships. Also, like, literally 9/10 of the characters on this show are members of the Pierce family, and then the other 10th are murderers.
Villains, yeah.
So there's not really anyone.
I would have crack shipped Foudy and what's her face, the lady she fought with, Cyanide, if they hadn't, like, killed them both off.
Why?
But otherwise, I got nothing. So, Black Lightning, naughty or nice for 2018?
Naughty. Naughty, naughty, naughty. For propping up this toxic, teenage, angsty crap over Thunder Grace. Like, Kennifer, I don't even know, like, how or why they decided that was the ship that they wanted to promote, but it was the wrong choice. And then, you know, obviously over Thunder Grace and even over Jefferlyn. And, like, generally not spending enough time in building up Thunder Grace or just investing in Grace in general. And then for throwing away the ship that they were semi-interested in with Jefferlyn to the wayside. So they had, like, a decent anchor ship in season one. So I don't really understand why they decided, like, I don't really like that anymore. Let's do, you know, abusive teenagers running away together. That sounds like a good plan. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And for that reason, I'm making it naughty. Like, whereas Legends has several small but thriving ships, Black Lightning just has tugboats that can't sail their way out of a paper bag. So, I hope that they will finally deliver on the Thunder Grace that they promised and promoted, because they will be naughty until then, regardless of what they do with their other ships.
Yeah, definitely naughty. They chose to focus too much on a problematic relationship, underwrote, and pulled focus away from Thunder Grace at every turn, and almost completely ignored Jefferlyn. So you get no points this season. Black Lightning, I'm sorry. moving into our final show of this very long podcast, DCU's neglected elder child, Titans. Anchorship, DeCorey.
That is the anchorship.
Yes, it is the anchorship, but there's also things that we need to discuss about this anchorship and how they dealt with them this season. Thoughts?
Yeah. So yeah, DeCorey is definitely meant to be the anchorship, and in the sense that they act as parents in the family unit, in the core four, it makes sense. The actors have chemistry, all is well, but it is a weak anchorship, in my opinion, because Dick's focus is divided between, you know, he's got the romance with Corey, but then his heart is Rachel. Like, I don't think there's a way to, you know, separate that. So, not just that. Not only is Dick's heart Rachel, but, like, Corey would probably throw Dick under a bus or stab him herself if it meant saving Rachel as well. So, not that there's a problem with parents who love their kids as much as or more than they do each other. But, and it's not like they have competition on the anchorship front, because, like, Rachel and Gar are not posing a threat ship-wise. But it's hard when the romantic leading lady isn't the same person as the emotional linchpin of the story. Because in that case, you need to at least fully invest in the romance to show why it's as important as the family, right? So instead of doing that, and it had every reason to, because again, we're supposed to be, it's supposed to be a story about the core four, so we should be getting to see every episode how Dick and Corey work together to protect Gar and Rachel. That would be very, very easy and great to do. But instead, Titans will just skip from Dick and Corey hooking up to them just like kind of sort of breaking up without batting an eyelash. Like, we didn't even know that they were continuing to bone until they were like, what if we stop boning? And then they give us a finale worth of Dick and Dawn content that nobody asked for, with barely 2 minutes of reinforcement for Dick and Corey. So, again, a de facto contender for anchorship in the way that, you know, Kara and Alex is an anchorship would be the core four. But again, that's hindered by the fact that Corey and Gar are running far behind Dick and Rachel in terms of writer investment, in terms of screen time and storylines. So what they need to do next season is make some of that subtext into text and give us on-screen development for Corey and Dick, as well as full backstory for Corey, so that she looks just like that, she is shown to be just as important as Rachel and what's his name? Dick. And also, please give us on-screen development for the ship and romantic moments that I don't need a flashlight to see.
Yes. I definitely agree they need to flesh Corey out more in general. And I also agree that this is another show where the heart and the romantic anchors are split between Dick and Rachel as the heart and Dick Corey as the anchor ship, the romantic anchor ship. I feel that Corey has a slightly stronger edge over other love interest in the fact that Rachel is also invested in Corey. So, although Dick Rachel is the strongest emotional pairing on the show, I think the fact that Rachel also has a really strong relationship with Corey reinforces Dick and Corey's relationship as pseudo parents to Rachel and Gar. I think that on like three fronts of fan base, narrative and writer's investment, it has large fan base. Dick Corey is one of Dick's like primary ships in comic canon. Arguably one of the largest or one of the largest. So you have all of that going for that large fan base that wants to see them on screen together. You have narratively, I think that they put in the seeds for the ship. But the writer's investment is just like sporadic. And I think it's just really it's not just Dick Corey as a ship, but the show as a whole, that they just don't really seem to have a tight focus on where they want to go. I think that I agree with you that Dick Corey seems kind of sporadic in their love. And as far as you don't really get to see a lot of it, and they don't really explain a lot of it. Because definitely the first time that they hooked up, I know a lot of people had the feeling that she seduced him, but I had the feeling that he used sex as a way to distract her from asking him
for his emotional problems.
Yes, for his emotional problems. So he used his dick to try to distract Corey. It didn't work, but I feel like that was his primary motivation for doing that. And so, like, and then when you see in a couple episodes later, in their supposed breakup, like, I didn't even know y'all were still continuing to have sex after that one moment, because we didn't get to see any of that. You never talked about it. They have, like, a really strong chemistry with the two actors, and I feel like you can see how much they work together and how much they function well as parental units in this core four, but there's not a lot of investment in their relationship with each other. And I think you can see, like, glimpses of that. For example, like, when Corey accidentally hurts Rachel and she leaves, and Dick is really concerned enough to go after her and defend her to Donna, that this is not the person that Donna is meeting for the first time. Like, she's not really like this. Like, she kills people sometimes, but she's not a killer kind of thing. So you can see, like, there is some emotional attachment on Dick's part in his relationship with Corey, and you can see some emotional attachment on Corey's part, how she really wants to get into Dick's issues with being Robin and his issues with Bruce. So you can kind of see how they care for each other, but there's large gaps of their love story that's just not being included in the narrative because the writers are more interested in taking side stories that no one asked for. And then again, you have, like, the finale with this whole, like, Dick Don bullshit that just didn't really add anything. It wasn't even, like, none of the characters even wanted this in the story. So, like, why are you doing this when even your characters don't want you doing this? Don is happily in a relationship with Hank, and Dick is building something with Corey. No one asked for Dick and Don. There's no... they had to force reminding the audience that Dick and Don existed through Donna propping up Don over Corey in the episode before to lead into this whole imagined narrative that Don has more of a press. They have to, like, insert Don forcibly into the core four and kick Corey out of it to make the story. And that's just, I don't really know what they're doing with that, but that is kind of, like, it detracts from the story that they actually should be telling with Dick and Corey. So, I don't know. It's, like, up and down. I feel like there's a basis, there's seeds for the ship to be the anchor ship, but I think the writer's lack of focus overall really hurts them in the long run.
I agree that the anchor ship is definitely Dick Corey, and it does have a fan base for sure, but the writer's investment, like you, both of you, said, is super weak, and that lack of investment shows up on screen. So they co-parent and take responsibility for the protection of Gar and Rachel, but they haven't established them with a solid foundation outside of the family or team dynamic. And there wasn't any romance in their relationship either, and Dick was clearly more focused on Rachel, but I'd argue he was focused on his own issues 90% of the time throughout the first season. And I think the writers defined their relationship with sex and replaced that with actually showing their feelings develop for each other, because after the first time, they jumped right into them sort of breaking up, except we never knew, so they thunder graced them. We popped back into their relationship. We didn't even know what the hell had happened to them before, only to find out that they were still sleeping together, but it was very fragmented and, like, there's no consistency. But again, like Jess said, that's the DNA of the show. Like, there's no consistency. It's just kind of all over the place. So the anchor ship suffers because of that.
And I feel like you can also argue with the fact that Corey is being played by a black woman and Dawn is being played by a white woman, that there's, like, you know, there's, like, a lot of stigma of, like, black women just being, like, sexual objects and sexual things. And, like, a lot of Dick Corey's relationship, not, like, aside from parents, but they were, like, romantic relationship. It's defined by them having, like, sex one time and them, like, having sex off screen and then breaking up kind of thing. Whereas, like, I don't know, Dick and Don, like, the whole, like, finale with them, like, playing house together is just being, like, very, like, romanticized. It's supposed to be, like, in the light and supposed to be, like, Dick's, like, perfect life or whatever. And so, I don't know. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's disgusting. And as far as the beta ship, there's sort of two, but not really.
Yeah. It's too early to be decided, but I feel like there you could make arguments for two of them, either Hawk or Dove or Rachel and Gar.
Right. I vote for Rachel and Gar precisely for the sake of keeping it in the family. Like, because it's like, again, you want the core four to be the main part of the show. So it would make the most sense to have Rachel and Gar be the ones paralleling Dick and Corey. And also, it would be, again, like you said, like the beta couple should look up to the alpha couple, right? So it's like literally like they see them as parental figures. They base their interactions or they base their, you know, decisions in life on what Dick and Corey are doing. Plus, Dick and Corey have moved pretty fast. So I think that Rachel and Gar could easily do the opposite and be like an actual slow burn, the way that lots of submarine ships tend to be, or even that platonic but questionable dynamic that Renee and Dinah have, or that Caitlin and Cisco have in My Deluded Mind. because, like, you know, as I've brought up many, many times, my only problem with Rachel and Gar is the age difference between the actual actors. So if you leave them in romantic limbo, where they're clearly the ship, but we're not actually seeing the forward movement yet because they're babies, then great. I have no issue with that. Let's make that happen. Plus, Hank and Dawn are too separated from the storyline, or at least so far as he's wanted to be of any use. Like, literally, they are useless. And the emphasis on their relationship and the pieces we get of their backstory only draw Dick further away from Corey, further away from the core four, into a love triangle that he has no business being a part of. So I think that less emphasis on Hank and Dawn is what we need. And there's not really a parallel. You can't, I mean, I guess you could draw a parallel of like Dick and Corey fight together and Hank and Dawn fight together, but they haven't used it in a way that would be a useful parallel, I think. Yeah. Like, the most useful was when Dick and Dawn were together in the dream world, but there was that one scene that suggested that maybe Dawn should be with Hank and maybe Dick should be with Corey. And if that's the way that you were going to use it, then keep it, because I don't want Dick and Dawn together. So I don't need to see how those two are the superior ships. I already know that. There you go.
Yeah, I feel like he's only involved in Hank and, or Hank and Dawn are only presented to be a triangle with Dick that none of these characters want to be in. I do think overall that the show has presented these two potential betas that are both slightly problematic. The argument for Rachel and Gar, I agree with you, is a stronger one, that they're both, they're the other half of the core four family, and so they parallel Dick and Corey in a lot of ways just within the family unit. So, like, Rachel and Gar have each other's back much the same way that Dick and Corey do and support each other's decisions. Like, that one episode where Rachel wants to go save her mom, and, you know, Dick and Corey rank up, and then Gar pretends to, but then he's like, no, I really have your back, Rachel, and so they pair off. So that's kind of like a you know, easy, like, parallel four within them. And then, you know, Dick and Rachel have a very strong relationship, and it's not as strong, but Corey and Gar also have kind of a connection and a strong kind of relationship just between the two of them. So you can do parallels multiple ways within that core four. And I think also another thing working from them is that at least Corey, I don't know how she does it, but she has picked up on Gar's romantic, possibly, feelings towards Rachel, and has brought it up multiple times. So that's another kind of sign that this is signaling this is our submarine ship for the show, the fact that Corey has, like, picked up and vocalized that Gar has feelings towards Rachel. The only slightly problematic thing, like Tati said, is that in real life, Ryan is 23 and Tegan is 14. So that hinders a lot of what writers will be able to do for them within the show until Tegan becomes the age. And then you have on the other side Hawk and Dove, but they're not really more desirable of a subship. They don't really parallel Dick and Corey that well. But both actors are of age, so like 0.1 to Hawk and Dove, I guess. You know, you're both like legal. I feel like their introductory episode didn't really establish them as a great couple, between Hank's like erectile dysfunction and his jealousy and Don's like random daydreams about Dick. Like the whole relationship really didn't seem to make much sense in episode 2. But their second episode, Hawk and Dove, while being badly placed within the season as a whole and not really advancing the plot at all, I think it did a much better job at developing their backstory and their romance more than Rachel and Gar just in general, just because it was all like focused in that one episode. You see how they found each other through their pain and how they got together and how they got into the superhero business together. And I understand more why they stuck together as a team, but while it built up their foundation, it also caused a lot more questions and holes and confusion, because now I have no idea how, based on their timeline of how they met, how does Dick fit into this equation enough to have a relationship with Dawn? So it doesn't really seem, you know, the Hawk and Dove episode did a good job establishing why they are a ship, but it also didn't do a good job of establishing how Dick fits into that, Dick Dawn fits into the Hawk Dove timeline. And more than anything, it just reinforces how unnecessary Dick Dawn is. And the fact that the writers chose to double down on that in the finale, rather than continuing to build both ships separately, their anchor ship especially, is just like annoying that, you know, that's what you chose to do rather than continuing to build on your anchor ship. So.
And that's why that dream baby needs to get to the paternity checked.
I think it baby's Hank's.
Yeah. I also think the beta ship is Gar and Rachel more so than Hank and Dawn, just because I feel like Hank and Dawn were more or less there to create angst in the finale or make Dick jealous or something having to do with Dick. Their established relationship developed better in the second standalone episode, but it's still tied back to him or like helping the core four somehow. And they were pretty far removed from any of the major stuff that was happening on screen until Dreamworld Dawn had to remind us that Dick had feelings for Corey. Like, just in case anyone missed it, he does have feelings somewhere. Gar and Rachel had more time to develop over the course of the season, and their relationship grounded the show and also tied back to the main plot in some way. So they do parallel Dick and Corey, but it's also an issue because on screen, like you guys said, they're trying to make Gar and Rachel be on the same page while Ryan Potter is much older in real life. So it's really weird to watch. But I could also see them maintaining a platonic beta ship down the line because they haven't gone into major romantic territory yet. So they haven't pulled that trigger. On to the crack ship corner. Who do we crack ship on this show? Because there's Donna with everyone, I guess.
Yeah, there's not a lot of options right now. I'd say like Donna and Corey, just because it's too early to tell. And I like, I know some people had some issues with their first interaction with Donna, basically like slamming Corey. And apparently, like, I'm not really that deep into Titans fandom to know, but apparently like a lot of people really jumped on Donna when she came into the show because they don't like Corey. And so a lot of them like cheered at the sight of her like slamming Corey to the ground and all that. I don't like those people, but I feel like, you know, Donna and Corey is possibly another kind of like, there are Dinah Laurel light in the sense that they start out, or maybe like a little bit like Zari and Charlie, that there's like friction at their first meeting, but they soon find out they have like a lot more in common than they thought, and that can grow into something beautiful. If the writers actually like write stuff for Corey.
Right. Don and Corey would be great. I'd be here for that. Because, I mean, there aren't very many platonic ships on the show that I would want to move beyond platonic, because most of the relationships on the show tie back to Dick, and I don't really need him to date anybody else. No. So, womp womp. But since Hank sucks, and I don't like him, I would also be cool with Donna and Don, or Corey and Don, or Babs and Don, or anyone, any combination of people that don't involve Dick. So yeah,
Connor.
And also can't. Oh,
Connor's coming. I would Connor do Connor and Corey just
Connor
because.
And Corey. Possible.
Just because they're both aliens. I really do hope that this is maybe like a prediction for season two or whatever, that because Connor is technically an alien, or that he also doesn't really have memories because he's a clone, that his story will like be told through Corey, or that she'll have like a lot to do with his story because she also knows about like being an alien and not having memories or whatever. So I feel like that could be potential for something if the writers care. And also like potential triangle for Dick to be annoyed at Corey and Connor, so.
I'm here for that scenario.
I crack ship Don and Corey with everyone except the underage children and Hank. And Dick, for now.
No Don and Dick. They are siblings.
Yes. All right, final thoughts on Titans being naughty or nice.
What do you think?
It's naughty.
Yeah, it's naughty. Cybunny's main ship in favor of one that makes no sense within the context of the narrative, although maybe in favor of is too strong, but in the finale he was definitely in favor of, and it was nonsense. And also for making me hyper-focus on actor ages when it should just be an adorably innocent baby ship that I love with all my heart.
Yeah, like, definitely naughty for introducing an unnecessary and lopsided love triangle that no one asked for or actually wants. And I really do think, like, I'm convinced that they only did Dick Don because Mika Kelly came on board. And that's the reason why Detective Amy, or whatever, died in, like, episode two. And I'm pretty sure she's probably supposed to be more important than she actually was.
She should have been, yeah, absolutely. Definitely naughty for not establishing a stronger bond between Dick and Corey from beginning. And for being inconsistent with showing their development as a potential couple, and for giving us an unnecessary angst between Don, Dick, and Corey, and for wasting our time with Don and Hank when it didn't tie back to the main plot at all. So,
Titans, for everybody
Titans gets
Flash
all
Legend.
The coal. Yes, lots of coal being handed out. Hopefully, 2019 they will do better. This ends our Love Boat Part 5. Naughty or nice? Send us all your lovely thoughts and feedback on ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, whether you agree with our thoughts on all these ships. And you can also email us at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. Happy New Year's, everyone.
Happy New Year.
We'll be back the week after next.
Yeah, right?
And we'll be back the next week.
We'll be on vacation.
We'll be on vacation.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.